Good Wednesday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of NRA News, Cam and Company. Sponsored by our friends at Nosler. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host. Glad you've joined us today. Have a fantastic program for you. Michael Barone, the Dean of American Politics with the Washington Examiner, going to be with us a little bit later on in the hour. He says, if we have a brokered GOP convention, this will not be your grandfather's brokered convention, or maybe your great-grandfather's brokered convention. Really, the last time, you got to go back to 1924 for one of those smoke-filled room conventions on the GOP side. We'll talk about it with Michael Barone. Later in the hour, John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show. This was our deal of the day yesterday, the murder of Tyshawn Lee, the 9-year-old in Chicago, Illinois, and the career criminal who is being held for his murder. This guy should have been behind bars. He did 2 years and a month of a 5-year sentence. Before he was let out, stands accused not only of the murder of Tyshawn Lee, but the murder of a 20-year-old woman and the wounding of a, believe she was 19 years old. We're learning more about this individual. No fewer than 3 arrests for illegally carrying a firearm. He apparently lured this little boy into an alleyway, kind of befriended him, picked up a basketball that the child was playing with, said, hey, you know, can I buy you something? Can I buy you a juice box, something like that? Lured him into an alley before brutally murdering him. Apparently bragged about this, according to police, to a cellmate. And we have people in Chicago that, and not just Chicago, around the country, say, well, what this shows is the need for more gun control laws. Clearly, this shows the need for more gun control laws. That this convicted felon who illegally obtained a firearm, who should, again, not have been on the streets in the first place, because he should have been behind bars serving that 5-year sentence. But somehow this goes back to the need for more gun control laws. So we're going to talk with John Cardillo. He's a former New York police officer. And I want to ask John, What's going on in Chicago right now? Homicides are double what they were this time last year. The homicide clearance rate, as we talked about in the program yesterday, is down to 14.7% for crimes this year. 14.7%. There is a greater than 4 in 5 chance that if you commit a murder and homicide, that you commit a murder in Chicago right now, police won't come and arrest you. Now, hopefully, again, that rate goes up. Not every murder case gets solved right away. Not every murder case gets solved. But let's hope that the clearance rate goes up this year. Right now, it's really low. And the violence is really high. And we keep seeing reports from there in Chicago that police officers are not making as many stops, not making as many contacts. Thanks to an ACLU lawsuit, the contact form they have to fill out every time they make contact with somebody has now doubled. I mean, look, it's not like it went from, you know, a 4-page report to an 8-page report. It went from a 1-sided sheet to a 2-sided sheet, but that's still more time. And maybe more importantly, these specialized gang units, all dismantled by the now former commissioner or superintendent there in Chicago, Gary McCarthy. So you've had a change in leadership. The new head, I'm sure, wants to bring in new ideas. I'm sure he really wants to bring this crime rate down. But is there that transitional institutional turmoil that's actually making it harder for the rank and file on the streets of Chicago to do their job? And by the way, whatever happened to Rahm Emanuel? Where is he? Cameron, he is still the mayor, right? I mean, I know that there were calls for him to step down and all, but he didn't do it when we weren't looking, right? I know he went off to Cuba. He came back after Christmas, right?
Right. He really had. It is pretty amazing, that, you know, with Chicago in the news for so many awful reasons. And I do love this city, and I've been there many, many times. It's a beautiful, great, fun city, but it's just become a place you just can't even go to anymore. And the fact that he's almost skating through all this. He doesn't get – Gary McCarthy got pushed out. He was the first scapegoat. And, you know, of course, when you look at, like, I think her name is Bertha Lewis, head of the Chicago Teachers Union, there's lots of grassroots mm-hmm. hatred of Mayor Emanuel. So if I was him, I'd be hiding too, because it looks like the city is having buyer's remorse in a major, major way. But, you know, they'll elect the next guy just the same – same politics, same party. Nothing will change with the new mayor. So, but I would lay low, too.
I suppose that's the wise political move. But we'll talk about it again with John Cardillo. And it's interesting, too. There was a I think it was the Chicago Sun-Times had another update on where concealed carry holders live in Chicago and in Cook County. And what they found is that some of the neighborhoods with the highest concentration of concealed carry holders have very low crime rates. As a matter of fact, one of these neighborhoods has not seen a homicide since 2014. Which in Chicago, that appears to be a substantial milestone. But there are a couple of other neighborhoods, zip codes. This is how they broke it down by zip code. A couple of other zip codes that do have high crime rates and have seen their crime rates increasing. And they, too, are home to some of the largest concentrations. I think they're fourth and fifth in terms of a per capita concealed carry holders. So, yeah, we are seeing people in, you know, good neighborhoods become concealed carry holders. But we're also seeing good people in bad neighborhoods become concealed carry holders, too. That is happening. And, you know, these stories of self-defense, they do show up with some regularity in the city of Chicago. Unfortunately, again, the stories of murders like Tyshawn Lee show up as well. So we'll talk again with John Cardillo about what's going on in Chicago. Kimberly Corbin will join us next hour, rape survivor, self-defense advocate, saying that Title IX makes the case for campus carry. I don't think the opponents of campus carry are going to want to hear what Kimberly has to say. That's why I'm glad she's coming on the show. Gabby Hoffman from Counterculture writing at Town Hall, the presence of guns on campus, she says, will not kill free speech. I happen to agree with her. I mean, look at the attacks on free speech that we are seeing on college campuses right now that don't have campus carry. The idea that we're hearing from some professors that, well, this is going to chill free speech. You know, this is the last bastion. You can't speak. Apparently, you can't speak your mind right now on college campuses. There was the latest I saw. We're going to talk with Robbie Suave from Reason. He's got a piece of the Daily Beast, the college that wants to ban history. Yeah, that's great. Not quite what you think, but it's close enough. But I saw yesterday at USC, private college, Southern California, somebody has filed impeachment papers against a student government, student senator, for the thought crime of inviting Milo Yiannopoulos, I think I'm pronouncing that correct, to speak there at USC. And for that crime of thinking incorrect thoughts and encouraging others to think incorrect thoughts, apparently they don't think that he deserves to serve in student government, even though apparently he must have been elected, right? Now, there are some, and this is one of the things I want to talk with Robbie about, because he was getting into this yesterday. I saw on Twitter with someone who was arguing that, look, this isn't a big deal, right? I mean, this is happening, but these students, these activists, those who are trying to chill free speech, they're not arguing from a position of power. They are the underdog
in this fight. So you really don't need to treat them as a serious threat because they don't have that institutional authority. I got to say, strikes me as a really weird argument because that's exactly what they're trying to get, is more power and authority to put their ideas into practice, right? And we are also seeing, again, around the country, on a number of campuses, administrators who are saying, okay. And we are also seeing, it should be noted, on a couple of other campuses, administrators who are saying, whoa, time out. This is not what college is about. University of Chicago reiterated its commitment to freedom of speech and freedom of expression. The Foundation for Individual Rights in Education has held up their speech code as something that other colleges and universities should emulate because it actually protects the freedom of speech as opposed to trying to declare that freedom to be overrated or that freedom to be incompatible with others' hurt feelings. Yeah, we'll talk about it with Robbie Suave at Reason coming up in hour three. And our friend Kurt Schlichter, the author of Conservative Insurgency, writer of many columns, veteran of, well, a couple of actual wars, but also a veteran of many TV appearances. Although, again, not too many on the Don Lemon show lately, but I'm sure Don will be rectifying that oversight here before long. Kurt will join us in hour three. We have our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCorp Defense. We have our deal of the day and our good guy of the day. As a matter of fact, not only do we have our deal of the day, but we have an update from one of our previous deals who is now back in court. Yeah. Shocker, right? Someone who got a plea bargain up before a judge again. So we'll talk about that coming up in hour three as well. Plus, we are following all of the day's top Second Amendment news and information for you. State houses around the country are considering bills today. We've got anti-gun bills up in Maryland. I did see reports from WTOP there in Annapolis that there were folks on both sides who were there at the State House. So thank you to those gun owners who made the trip to Annapolis to stand up for your Second Amendment rights, even in the state of Maryland right now, where I know that it is hard going. In Oklahoma, we've got a suppressor bill that could be heard on the floor of the House today. It's House Bill 2637. It would make it legal for Oklahomans to hunt with a suppressor on both public and private land. You know, we're talking with Jazz Shaw about this yesterday. Reuters kind of finally picked up on the fact that a number of states around the country have approved suppressor bills over the last couple of years. And again, in many cases, I'd say in most cases, with a very broad bipartisan support. And we've talked with Knox Williams from the American Silencer Association about this phenomenon, because I'm amazed that in an issue as polarizing as the gun issue is in politics, that you can see, you know, in some states, I think they've had unanimous approval for these bills. And Knox says it's a matter of education. It's a matter of explaining to folks, look, this is not Hollywood. This life is not a James Bond movie. And suppressors are not going to make your gun sound like a blow dart. So get that out of your head. Why don't you go to the range, try one out, or we can explain how this works. We can show you the decibel levels without a suppressor and with a suppressor. You can see that, again, there's still sound. We can introduce you to people who use suppressors. They can tell you why. It's worked. We've seen bills in well over a dozen states get signed into law. I got to tell you, actually, you know, it kind of restores some hope if you are slightly cynical and jaded about the process and the willingness of people to learn and consider new facts. It's actually a very heartwarming political story. So again, we'll talk about House Bill 2637. It had passed unanimously in Oklahoma, again, out of the House Wildlife Committee, but could be heard on the floor of the Oklahoma State House today. And we will keep our eyes on news coming out of Oklahoma. Right now, though, we're going to take a quick time out. When we return here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, Michael Barone, the Dean of American Politics, columnist of the Washington Examiner, talking about the potential for a brokered convention and what that might actually look like in 2016. Stick around. We'll be back with more. NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this.
Speaking with Bobby Wiggins with Warrior Outdoors. Welcome to NRA News. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great.
Well, right here on your card, sir, it says Healing for Heroes. That's Tell great. Us, what are you all about? What do you do?
Warrior Outdoors is a nonprofit organization. We are geared towards helping veterans, particularly with post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injuries. We take vets and first responders to on outdoor activities, hunting, fishing, monster truck shows, to paintball. I mean, just anything outdoors to help prevent withdrawal.
How'd you get this started?
I'm actually a service-connected disabled vet myself. I'll go ahead and tell you, my rating with the VA is 70%. When I was medically discharged from the Marine Corps, I did a lot of my own therapy. I signed an inch-thick book of papers saying I couldn't talk about this, couldn't see, do anything.
Right.
So I went out to a tree stand with a hunting rifle, and that's where I spent the majority of my time doing my own rehab. So it was like a light switch that clicked and said, I cannot be the only person like this. So I started this organization and built a great team to help me out, and that's now I'm sitting here with you.
That's so awesome. It's great, Bobby, to see you, when people do this. And out of necessity, what's born this kind of stuff. So mm-hmm. out of necessity was born Warrior Outdoors, because this is what you had to do for yourself, and now you're doing it for others.
That's correct. Not saying that any other organization out there is bad, because they're all good. It's just we can't have enough organizations like this helping veterans.
Absolutely.
We have 22 veterans a day. Right now, the numbers from the DOD, it's 22 veterans a day committing suicide.
Oh.
One is too many.
How do we get more information about Warrior Outdoors?
You can visit the website, warrioroutdoors.org.
Bobby, thanks for what you do, and thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you.
Speaking with Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels. Jacqueline, welcome to NRA News. How are you?
I'm doing so great. How are you doing?
I'm doing so well, and better now that you're here, by the way.
Oh, thank you so much.
You light up the set.
Oh,
so
I'm glad to hear.
Tell us, what is Armed in Heels all about?
So Armed in Heels is an online retailer, and our goal is to support women who feel empowered and to feel empowered as they enter the shooting community. My husband and I started this company when he introduced me to firearms. I cried. I was terrified. I tried to go enter the industry to get more information and to engage and learn, but it was really intimidating for me. And so what we did is create Armed in Heels to support the working woman, the empowered women, the wife, the mother that wants to get engaged in a safe way.
Okay, so you said you went and tried it. You cried. You were terrified. Was that before or after you shot?
I think he took it out of the case. I cried. And then he put it away. And
I see.
It
okay.
maybe took 2 years to get the guts
really?
To do it again. And I don't want women to have that experience.
No way.
So my goal is to make sure that they have an opportunity to get into the industry in a way that really makes them feel empowered and supported and helps establish their identity further.
I think that's an awesome idea. So, Jacqueline, how do you do this?
So what we do is we very carefully target lots of products that are actually made for women. That does not mean pink. That does not mean colors. That means if I see tack pants, they better fit my curves and they better help me conceal the way I want. And holsters, the same thing. So we really go out, pressure the manufacturers, and get those products to our women so that they can have them and integrate them with part of their lifestyle.
Awesome. You seem to have it figured out. This, I love your approach. I love your idea.
Great.
So how can people get more information about Armed in Heels?
So we can go onto our website, which is www.armedinheels.com.
Right.
You can also visit us on Facebook at Armed in Heels. And we're certainly looking to bring a good voice out there, so we hope we can get lots of women to engage.
Keep up the good work. Jacqueline Kelly with Armed in Heels, thanks for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you so much.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. All right, still to come on the program, John Cardillo, host of the John Cardillo Show, will be with us. And, I said on yesterday's program that I think we're just in one of those election years where nobody really knows anything about what's going to happen. You can make your predictions, but you might be well off. We saw that in Michigan last night where the polls had Hillary Clinton cruising to victory and instead Bernie Sanders won. This is just a really weird election year. And, you know, even the experts, I think, oftentimes aren't going to know what's ahead. But I will say this. Our next guest, Michael Brown from the Washington Examiner, knows an awful lot about politics. And, Michael, I am eager to pick your brain, sir. How are you?
Well, I'm okay, and I'm ready to discuss the visit of Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau to Washington today, which I imagine is the first thing on your listeners' mind.
Oh, of course. Of course. I can't tell you the number of messages I've been getting. What does he think about Trudeau? Of course, most of them think it's the Doonesbury comic, but I often get confused with that as well. No, I'm not going to ask any questions about Justin Trudeau, but I am going to ask some questions. You have a column about if we do see a brokered convention this year, you say this is not likely to be your grandfather's brokered convention. And you make a very persuasive argument simply because of the advancements in technology. It's not going to be. We don't handle politics the same way, right? So this can't be.
Well, the last multi-ballot presidential nomination came in the Democratic Convention in 1952. Not coincidentally, 1951 was the year of the first direct dial long-distance telephone call. That direct distance dialing didn't become common to the late 50s and universal until the 1960s. It was in 1958 was the first scheduled jet aircraft, passenger jet in the United States. And then we have to wait a little while until Al Gore invented the Internet. But, you know, the fact is that in the past, the conventions were a unique communications medium. They were the only place you could actually find out how many delegates candidates really had, and they were the only place in which politicians could literally negotiate with each other because they didn't meet that often. They didn't talk on long-distance phone. That's all changed now. To replicate those conditions, you would have to abolish long-distance telephone calling. You would have to abolish scheduled jet aircraft and private sector and private jets. And you'd have to shut down the Internet for a period of time. I don't think any of those things is likely to happen, and they certainly shouldn't. The fact is that if Donald Trump emerges from the last primary and caucus on June 7th, visibly short of the 1,237 delegates needed to nominate, there's going to be a lot of communication, brokering, if you will, negotiating, as Trump would put it, in the weeks in advance. People aren't going to wait till they get to Cleveland on July 18th to make deals, to ascertain who the delegates are really for, who they will be for on a second or third ballot if they're released from legal commitments. Those things will all be sorted out in advance because we have communications devices. I mean, the first media delegate count was done by CBS, the late Martin Plessner, in 1968. Before that, people didn't know how many delegates there were there. You had old-fashioned political bosses whose delegates were like the Tammany guy elected mayor of New York, who was asked who would be his police commissioner. His most important appointment, and his response in full was, "They haven't told me yet." Now we've got real delegates with email addresses, cell phone numbers, Facebook pages, Twitter accounts, and so forth. They're people that can be talked to, negotiated with, and I expect that campaigns are already laying the groundwork to do that kind of thing should Trump fall short of 1237.
Now, that doesn't mean that it won't be messy and chaotic in its own way. It just won't be happening there at the convention. It'll
some
be happening,
of the mess,
right?
And chaos is going on as we speak.
I would, yeah, that sounds like a fair assessment. And I realize, you know, again, I don't think anybody really knows what's going to happen here. What do you think about the possibilities, though, the chances of this getting to a brokered convention or at least a convention where nobody has the required number of delegates to get the nomination on the first ballot?
Well, you know, I think you have an unusual situation here. In five of the 10 presidential nomination contests that Republicans have had since primaries became the primary selection method of delegates in 1972, You've had a winner who wins a plurality of delegates and wins most primaries. Other candidates drop out. That winner is largely acceptable to most people in the party, and his nomination is accepted, and the delegate line falls in, delegate count falls into line. It probably won't happen this year because you've got a front runner, Donald Trump, who is not acceptable to uncommitted party leaders almost unanimously, and who is not acceptable to judge from recent polls, the most recently NBC Wall Street Journal, ABC Washington Post poll, probably to a majority of Republican voters, even though he's coming in first in multi-candidate races. Not all of them, but most of them. So I think this is a different situation. Trump was trying to tamp that down and be on his acceptable mode in his monologue last night. I mean, other candidates have victory speeches. He does a sort of rather more lengthy than Johnny Carson monologue on election night, the last couple. But if you look at the delegate count between Super Tuesday and last night, even though Trump won handsomely in Michigan and Mississippi, he's actually won fewer delegates in those 7 days than Ted Cruz did. He did not win a majority of delegates during that period of time. So, I think a lot will depend on the results in Florida. 99 delegates, winner take all. Ohio, 66 delegates, winner take all. Illinois, 69 delegates with, in effect, winner take all by congressional district. Those are all on March 15th.
Michael Barone with the Washington Examiner. Thank you, as always, sir, for coming on the program. Always enjoy
it. Thank you. Thank you.
You bet. John Cardillo coming up a little bit later on in the hour, talking about the murder of Tyshawn Lee in Chicago. Next hour, Kimberly Corbin, who says Title IX actually makes the case for campus carry. Now, you know, it's interesting, talking with Michael Barone about the road ahead. I mentioned again last night, nobody thought Bernie Sanders was going to win Michigan. At least none of the polls suggested that Bernie Sanders was going to win Michigan. So this is, you know, again, this is a year where the polling itself has been, and pollsters will say it's getting harder and harder to ensure an accurate sample. There's always going to be a margin of error. But we've seen some really, really wonky polls here, and pollsters will tell you their job is getting more and more difficult, which to me means less and less attention should be given to these polls. But instead, it seems we are paying more attention in every election cycle to the polling data. In fact, it's something we kind of become addicted to. We want to see what do the latest polls say, even when what the latest polls say might very well be absolute nonsense. And so you, again, you know, you've got these experts who are reacting to polling that may or may not be accurate, basing their judgments off of this data that may be garbage and may be spot on and likely is somewhere in between. And we just keep seeing a lot of folks get perpetually surprised here throughout this campaign cycle as to what's happening next. And I really, truly think that the only way that you can really approach it as someone who is part of the so-called smart set is to acknowledge nobody really knows what the heck's going on here. As Michael said, even the experience of going back and looking at history, all right, well, what did brokered conventions look like in the past? Well, you can look, and it might give you, again, some valid information about the horse trading that goes on behind the scenes, but it's not going to play out the way it did in 1924 or in 1952, because that's not the world that we live in. It's not how we communicate. So the idea, you know, and this I think is important information, the idea that there might be some chaotic spur-of-the-moment decision that happens on, like, the 53rd ballot at a brokered convention. Look, I think it may still happen. Because, again, you're dealing with thousands of individuals. It is messy to try to coordinate and communicate with thousands of individuals, particularly if you have multiple campaigns or candidates that are trying to communicate with those thousands of individuals. It's in some ways it might actually be easier to do it at a convention than trying to communicate over Skype and email and direct message and phone calls, right? So we could still see, I think, a messy convention. But it's not going to play out exactly as it did before. As Michael said, there's probably already these conversations taking place, already going on here. I think the best, again, that people can offer this at this point is the perspective that Michael Barone brings to the table, reminding us of what it looked like before, similarities to past election cycles, but also that acknowledgement that things are still very much different this time around. Boy, are they different this time around. All right, John Cardillo from the John Cardillo Show going to join us in a few minutes talking about the murder of Tyshawn Lee in Chicago. I mentioned a few minutes ago the Chicago Sun-Times had a story about the number of concealed carry holders there in Chicago and where these concealed carry holders live. Chicago Tribune with a story, 21 shot over 20 hours in Chicago, Illinois. They say the period was more violent than the entire previous weekend when one person was killed, 14 wounded, and ranged across the city from the northwest side to downtown to the far south side of Chicago. Burst of violence, they say, included three shootings in an area of 63rd Street and Sacramento Avenue within 2 hours. Left a man dead and three others wounded, including two 16-year-old boys. 5 miles away in the Gresham neighborhood, four people were shot in three incidents. More than 500 people have been shot in Chicago since the first of the year. More than 100 homicides. They say that this is the most violent start of a year since the late 1990s, when crime was on the way down. And what's going on here in Chicago? Why are we seeing this surge in violence? Gun control advocates say it's because of the gun laws in places like Indiana and Illinois and around the country. But again, in Chicago, the people who are committing these violent crimes, at least the few who have been arrested, don't appear to be FOID card holders. Most of them have lengthy criminal histories that include felon in possession charges. So what's going on in Chicago? And what can be done to turn things around? Because you can't answer that second question until you answer the first question about why is this happening. And some of it, again, may be because of these things that we've mentioned before. Fewer contacts by police officers. The demobilizing of the specialized gang units. But is that the only thing accounting for the increase in violence in Chicago? I doubt it. Is it the fact that in Chicago, again, the small number of individuals who are committing a disproportionate amount of violent crime is because they're getting away with it? At least until that point where they're not. I mean, how much of it stems from the fact that the man who's accused of murdering Tyshawn Lee was out on the streets when he should have been behind bars? And that is not unusual. That is the status quo. That is the norm. You get sentenced to five, you don't do five. You may not even do half your sentence. Chicago Police Superintendent John Escalante is the acting police superintendent. They haven't named a permanent replacement, which, again, might be an issue here. John Escalante said Tyshawn Lee's death was, quote, something far sinister than random violence. He said that his death was a, quote, targeted assassination because of his father's alleged gang ties. He said Tyshawn was targeted by a ranking member of a rival gang who was out on the streets when he should have been behind bars. And, you know, in all of the headlines and in all of the stories about Tyshawn Lee and the arrest, this information about the suspect, Dwight Boone Doty, is always buried in the story. I have yet to see one headline that says, that, remember, a headline now, a man accused of execution of 9-year-old boy served 2 years of a 5-year sentence before getting released on parole, or words to that effect. Accused killer of 9-year-old boy out on the streets when he should have been behind bars. Where's that headline? And how many other individuals, again, responsible for a for more than their fair share of violent crime in Chicago, how many more individuals are out there on the street right now? Went under what most of us think their sentencing should have been or was, would require that they still be behind bars. And how many more individuals will continue in this cycle until they commit a crime that is so heinous that it leaves the nightly news, it ends up on the front page of the paper, and then we pay attention to them? But only them, as an individual, don't pay any attention at all to the system that perpetrates this, that allows for a large number of individuals to think that they can get away with acting like this. They can get away with executing a 9-year-old boy because they might not get arrested. If they do, you know what? Nothing's happened to them before. When do we get to talk about that? I guess right after the break, because John Cardillo is going to join us. Stick around. We've got more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, on the way.
Speaking with Jeff Gorman, he's an MP in Australia and also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party Victoria. Welcome, sir, to NRA News.
Thank you.
And welcome to the States.
Thank you. I've been enjoying my nearly 3 weeks now. It's an awesome country. I've only managed to fire a gun once whilst I've been here in the 3 weeks. It's been more or less work, work, work.
Oh, that's too bad. Well, you got to have a little, take a little time to shoot. So tell us, Jeff, it's great we saw you here and we grabbed you, because let's talk about what's happening down in Australia. What's the latest on the fight for gun owners' rights down there?
Well, as you're aware, the current administration here has been using Australia as a poster child.
I noticed that, yes. Yeah.
So I'm here telling people that all is not what it seems. it's a case of, we have all these restrictions in Australia, and their public safety value is actually dubious at the best.
Okay. Give us a for instance.
Well, we have classifications of rifles. In 1996, we had a massacre in Tasmania.
Right.
And as a result of that, there was what was called the National Firearms Agreement was forced upon the states. Now, that classifies firearms into different sorts of firearms. A and B category are the normal sort of bolt actions and pump action rifles,
right,
and the usual sort of stuff. C category is for .22 semi-automatics and some centerfire rifles, and D category is for all the evil black rifles and so on.
They're so evil.
Now, with the B category, which is the general sort of centerfire thing, you can get pump action rifles, which is fine. But if the pump action rifle looks like an AR-15, for instance, it gets reclassified to the D category, which is all but impossible for a normal person to have. So it looks apparently kill.
Well, Jeff, the devil's in the details, and the bureaucrats really run the world, because they, with the paperwork and the machinations,
well,
they can make what seemingly innocuous regulations, Jeff, be very much not so.
Yeah, and that's the point I'm trying to bring. First of all, I mean, for our politicians, is, if there's no actual public safety outcome to it, why are we doing it? I mean, I've been a policeman in Australia before, in Victoria. I understand the need for, in our country, some rules that may or may not apply here. I'm not here to tell you how to run your country. But reclassifying a firearm based on its looks because apparently that's bad. I mean, that, there is no actual reason for that except an ideological push to get rid of firearms.
Speaking with Jeff Borman, he's an MP down in Australia. He's also chairman of the Shooters and Fishers Party of Victoria. All right, Jeff, so let's recap so far because I have more I want to talk to you about.
Sure.
All the stuff that the current administration is going around touting about how great everything is in Australia with gun laws, not exactly true.
No. No. Well, let's also, another thing they talk about, the theft of firearms from legitimate owners feeding the black market.
Right.
And they've also coined a term called the grey market, which is for firearms that weren't handed back in 1996.
Okay.
But that's just a cynical way of trying to tie the law-abiding people into the criminals, because what they're saying is these people just didn't hand in these guns. So they're either black or white, as far as I'm concerned. It's either legal or illegal.
Right.
There is no grey market.
Right. A legal gun is an illegal gun.
Yeah.
Right.
So, look, and effectively, the trying to use us as a poster child for gun control is just, it's unbelievable. The mainstream media, of course, don't want to have a bar of us. They don't want to have that discussion.
No.
Because we bring a narrative that completely opposes what they say.
It's easier for them just not to talk to you.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, I got to say, I haven't had the mainstream media beating down my door to put me on some of these shows where they talk about gun control. But maybe my invitation got lost in the mail.
Yeah, perhaps. Spam email or something like that.
Well, you just can't tell.
Yeah. So what's your reaction? You've been up here in the States in a few weeks. What's been your reaction from folks up here to what you have to say?
It's been fantastic. I'm finding a lot of people, so they'll say to me, oh, look, they'll get my guns over my cold dead hands and the Second Amendment and so on. But I also point out, people that come to these shows and the Dallas Safari Club convention where I was, they're law-abiding people, they're good people, they put into society. I ask them, do you really want to shoot a policeman that comes to your door to get your guns, or do you want to get shot by them and all this sort of thing? And I think the message I bring from that is, don't rely on the Second Amendment as such. You need to get yourself registered to vote, and you need to punish the people that are trying to take your guns away from you when you've done nothing wrong in the ballot box. And that way you avoid the whole problem.
Almost out of time. Just want to thank you, sir, for what you're doing, and thanks for being on NRA News.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, Farmville, Virginia. Beautiful Farmville, Virginia, site of the 2016 vice presidential debate. Who knows who those two individuals will be? Who knows if it'll just be two individuals? Probably going to just be two individuals now that Bloomberg not getting into the race. But that's coming up in October right now. Join us on the program, John Cardillo, host of The John Cardillo Show. John, how you doing, sir?
I am doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am good. I appreciate you joining us on the program. This was our deal of the day yesterday, the suspect in the murder of Tyshawn Lee. And there is some attention being paid to this case, but, you know, honestly, John, I'm looking here at a story in Chicago. Tyshawn Lee, tragic murder shows need for stronger gun laws. Now, here's a guy, the suspect in this case, convicted criminal, lengthy criminal history. As a matter of fact, he had been sentenced to 5 years in prison. He should have been behind bars at the time Tyshawn Lee was murdered. He stands accused of another murder committed a few weeks earlier. He did 2 years and a month out of a 5-year-long sentence. And John, I'll be honest with you, I'm gobsmacked as to how anybody could think what this case shows is the need for more gun control laws.
It is so ridiculous and stupid. All right, first of all, this guy, his last name is Doty, D-O-T-Y, right? 22-year-old guy, like you say, wanted in another murder. And if you know the details of that, it's almost as abhorrent as little Tyshawn Lee's murder.
Mm-hmm.
He saw two people in a car, saw a guy with dreadlocks, thought it might be a rival gang member, and just opened up and started firing into the car, killed a 19-year-old girl, wounded a 20-year-old guy. This is an indiscriminate killer. And Tyshawn Lee was killed in a gang war between the P-Stones and the Gangster Disciples, two of Chicago's most notorious gangs for decades. Using gun control as an excuse for not wanting to enforce laws against gangbangers, it's really disgraceful, and even more so to do it on the back of a dead 9-year-old innocent child.
All right, so let me ask you something, because you said this 9-year-old boy, Tyshawn Lee, his dad apparently was a gang member.
And this was a targeted killing. In fact, there have been reports that apparently this suspect had originally planned on torturing this 9-year-old boy and then decided, I'm going to lure him into this alleyway with the promise of buying him a juice box or something, and then I'm going to cold-blooded murder him. We've seen reports, John, that the previous superintendent, Gary McCarthy, who got canned a few months ago, that he had basically disassembled the city's gang units. He had called them cowboy units, had said, we're gonna return these officers to the streets. They're not going to be doing these specialized tasks anymore. When those units are disbanded, how much more difficult is it to understand who's beefing with who, where these gang fights are flaring up, where they need to redirect resources? Because it seems to me like there's an ebb and flow, right? It's not that every gang is actively at war with every other gang in Chicago, but the cops have to be able to know what's going on in order to not just react, but be proactive.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Look, and when you eliminate those units, when you decide to de-staff them, right? They like to say you're transitioning those units out of service. Now, when you kill those units, you're killing the most important tool law enforcement has. It's not your gun, it's not your baton, it's not your patrol car, it's intelligence. And these gang units, all they do is focus on gangs. 85% of what they do is intelligence, because without that, you can't go out and apprehend anybody. Now, I've said it on your show before. I say it on my show. I'm not a fan of Gary McCarthy. He wasn't a very effective supervisor in the NYPD. Crime and corruption in Newark PD spiked under him. So it doesn't surprise me that under Gary McCarthy there were murders in Chicago. And because of what he did in NYPD, he eliminated similarly effective units. But when you kill that gang intelligence camp, you're putting a blindfold on the police. It's not a cliche or an example. You're literally taking away the knowledge of what's going on the street and asking them to sort of predict it, but you're not allowing them to do what they need to do to effectively predict it. It's really suicidal from a criminal justice standpoint.
And then you add into the fact, so I know you weren't a fan of Gary McCarthy, but when you have a change in leadership, how easy is it to have an orderly transition, John? Or can that be part of the problem too? You've got somebody new coming in, they want to prove themselves different from the last guy in charge, and so they're going to be trying to enact their own things. It seems to be like that could also be sort of a chaotic thing for the department.
I think it's a little different in this case. With sheriff's departments, that tends to be the case. If the rank and file loves or hates a sheriff, mm-hmm. and a new sheriff is elected, then they tend to either love the new sheriff because he's not the old guy, or hate him because he's not the old guy. But with an appointed, in Chicago, it's called a superintendent. Other places, it's chief or commissioner. With an appointed guy like McCarthy and the new guy, every cop really knows, and I knew it in NYPD, that the mayor is really the one setting policy for the police department, because the head of the department serves at the leisure and pleasure of the mayor. And so in this case, morale was already low under McCarthy. The new guy is really filler. They've been interviewing chiefs from all over the country. Kathy Lanier from near you guys in D.C. declined the job. And so the cops know not much is going to change as long as Rahm Emanuel continues to hold the mayor's seat.
You know, and it's interesting. I jokingly asked Cameron if Rahm Emanuel was still mayor in Chicago or if he just decided to stay down in Cuba after Christmas, because you really haven't heard anything from Rahm Emanuel. He's kept a very, very low profile here, even as the violence has exploded in Chicago.
Yep. He's been non-existent. He's been ducking and covering because ultimately that's going to come back to him. I mean, if there's ever an audit done of orders handed down or meetings, you're probably going to see in the city hall log or police headquarters log many, many meetings between the mayor, the superintendent, you know, McCarthy, and then his replacement, or like a first deputy mayor type. And they're going to coincide with all of these high profile negative cases, whether it be spikes in shootings or the police involved shooting. And so Emanuel, it's going to be very easy to connect the paper trail on all of the bad things happening in Chicago right back to Rahm Emanuel. So it doesn't surprise me that he's being quiet.
No, it doesn't surprise me, but I'll tell you, if I lived in Chicago, I'd be pretty disappointed. But if I lived in Chicago, I'd be pretty disappointed for a variety of reasons, I think, with my political leadership. So let me ask you, John, what about the gun laws in Chicago and Illinois? in neighboring Indiana, the gun laws at the federal level. If we were to pass some sort of universal background check law across the country, would that bring down, in your opinion, the violent crime rate in Chicago? Would that help?
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely not. I mean, these you know, Peastones and gangster disciples have been killing each other with firearms since the early 1960s. And, you know, they've never abided by the laws on murder. Indiana has pretty good gun laws. I actually spend time up there. And I'm reciprocal with Florida. I don't even need to use my police ID. But it changes dramatically once you get to Illinois. Now, Illinois does now issue permits. Still pretty difficult in Chicago at state level. But, you know, Chicago PD tries to make it difficult, even though they can't anymore. But, no, it won't change a thing. It doesn't change it in D.C. Crime is up in New York, right? 60% of New Yorkers are now feeling less safe under de Blasio. Mm-hmm. Gun laws there have gotten more strict. Crime has risen. So we know scientifically that gun laws do nothing to prevent violent crime.
Do you have any theories as to why we are seeing violent crime start to rise in cities like Chicago, Baltimore, New York? I think Los Angeles crime was up. Again, crime has been going down for 20 years here. While there's been, again, you know, more and more gun owners, more and more concealed carry holders, more guns, less crime has just not been the case for the past two decades. So why is it, John, that we are starting to see this reversal in these decades-long trends?
I'll give you names. Sarah Rawlings Blake in Baltimore, Bill de Blasio in New York, Rahm Emanuel in Chicago, and the list goes on. When you get progressive politicians pandering to the lowest common criminal denominator, vilifying the police and praising the bad guys, this is what happens. I worked in New York first under David Dinkins, and when Rudy Giuliani was elected mayor, it was a sea change, both in reduction in crime and police morale, but also morale of the citizens, literally in weeks, not months. 3 weeks in, you could feel the difference. 3 weeks into Giuliani's administration, you felt the difference in the city.
Is that ultimately what it's going to take? These cities that you know, ultimately have been one-party rule for decades.
Yeah.
And, you know, we could talk about it being run by, you know, deeply progressive individuals. I happen to think one-party rule is kind of stultifying when you're, you know, talking about decades of one party being in charge. It's probably going to end up badly if you don't have a true two-party system. But is that, in your opinion, what it's going to take, having that actual turnaround and breaking through the party machinery and actually, you know, electing somebody with some fresh ideas?
You know what's interesting is that I don't understand certain cities. The residents scream and yell and cry about how crime is on the rise and their kids are being killed. But then they'll vote for the same policies all over again. But, yeah, it's going to take a sea change, a drastic change in ideology and policy in these cities. Because right now, look, Bill de Blasio is a one-term mayor. I can't see mathematically him being reelected, but that's probably not the case in Chicago. Even if Emanuel decides to go to the private sector or to higher office again, and he was chief of staff at the White House, I think that the Chicago machine is so powerful and entrenched, they're going to handpick the candidate. And Chicago's a scary one. I don't know if you can break that. It's like, you know, the current day Tammany Hall.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems that way. I don't know. And it seems to me, you know, you look at the last election, it was Rahm Emanuel was the more conservative, right, of the if you want to call it that, of the two candidates. I think the other candidate might have been declared himself to be a socialist. I don't know. I think he's a Bernie Sanders supporter at this point. So.
Wow.
You know, and that's the thing, I guess, you wonder, you can point out, look, it's been 50 years since you've had a Republican mayor, or you've even had, you know, Republicans on the city council. Maybe it's been a decade since you've had that. But at the same time, you also, if you want people to be able to make that change, you've got to give them the reasons. You've got to give them the knowledge necessary so that they know that a legitimate change is possible.
Well, right, and it's the machines, right? It's these political machines picking far-left candidates. I mean, look, Jim Webb is a Democrat, but if Jim Webb were the mayor of a city, I don't think that city would have high crime. I think Jim Webb would be pretty tough on crime and be pretty pragmatic about who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. It's just that it seems that the furthest left portion of the Democratic Party, but the socialists, the radicals, are the ones who are winning these seats. And that's what's really terrifying to me.
Well, we will we'll see what happens here in November, John. But I appreciate you coming on the program as always, sir, and look forward to talking to you again very soon.
I want to have you back on my show next week when we have some time to talk about the Second Amendment and the primary.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to do it.
All right, Cam. Thanks, always, as always.
We'll talk to you soon. John Cardillo, join us, host of the John Cardillo Show. Kimberly Corbin coming up next hour. Says Title IX makes the case for campus carry. Gabby Hoffman from Counterculture, right in at Town Hall, says professors, students, they don't need to be concerned that campus carry will lead to a chilling of speech. After all, it hasn't happened in Colorado or Utah or anywhere else where campus carry is already the law, but why let a little things like facts start mattering now, right? Stick around. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nozzlers, coming up right after this.
Speaking with Kevin Neuendorf with USA Shooting. Kevin, welcome back to NRA News. How are you, my friend?
Oh, it's great to be here. I'm doing wonderful. It's an Olympic year, so a lot of excitement building.
Man, oh, man, there's a lot of excitement. So a lot of things to talk about. We want to talk about Rio, of course. Mm-hmm. We're going to get to that. But first, you have a new campaign that you guys just launched. Tell me about it.
Well, it's the Shooting is My Olympic Sport campaign. So one of the things that we're trying to do is rally a community around the aspect of Olympic shooting. So not many people know that, you know, there's 15 Olympic disciplines, shooting events. And so what we're trying to do is gather everybody around this vast community that we have and really get them to rally around our Olympic shooting sports. So, you know, not many people may follow the Olympics. They, you know, they may know of gymnastics or track and field,
right, yeah,
but we're going to bring them to shooting. You know, we could all rally around that. So that's kind of what we're doing this year.
Awesome.
Going to have a lot of fun around it. So we developed this nice new logo. And just trying to bring everybody together around our cause.
I love it. So tell us about Rio. How's it looking?
Hey, we're looking good. We've got several world champions. Of course, we've got the return of, you know, Kim Rohde, a five-time Olympic medalist.
Great Kim Rohde. What a great ambassador for the shooting sport she is.
Yeah,
she's an ambassadress. I don't know. Yeah. Whatever the right word. She's awesome.
Yeah, whatever she is, she does it really well, so including shooting. So, you know, so she's got to make her spot still. That's how competitive our events are. Oftentimes, the hardest thing to do in the United States is make our own team.
Right. It's qualify, right?
Qualify.
Yeah.
Because there's that much depth. You know, Kim competes in skeet shooting. Well, we have a world champion in Morgan Kraft who's already earned her spot to Rio. So she beat out Kim.
Uh-oh, here we go.
So there's two spots, and Kim's in the lead right now, and we'll find out in May if she makes the team, but she's looking pretty good right now.
I'll tell you what, Kevin, backstep a little bit with me here talking about Rio then. Because, you know, this is where sometimes it gets confusing even for me. What are the current shooting events that are going to be in the Olympics?
Yeah, if you think it's confusing for you, what do you think I am? So I'm trying to explain it all. We got 15 Olympic events. We got five events in pistol, five events in shotgun, and five events in rifle.
So how does the U.S. Olympic Committee determine that, or how's it? Because didn't one of the events that Kim was in a few years ago got changed or worked in? I know they changed the sports a lot.
Yeah. So the International Olympic Committee really kind of sets the table in terms of what Olympic events in, and they're always looking at refactoring in a whole bunch of different things, whether it be gender equity or how well they play off on television or whatever it is. So they're always adding and subtracting events. So it's determined by the International Olympic Committee, and then they work with the International Federation for Shooting.
So now listen to that, folks. 15 shooting events in the Olympics. So shooting is not only my Olympic sport, but the Olympic sport. It's a big part of the Olympics. So it's important we all get to know about it.
Yeah, there's a couple facts there that are important. USA Shooting has won 107 Olympic medals all time. We've been in every Olympics since 1896.
Wow.
A lot of people wouldn't understand the success that we've had, but we're fourth most among all medals. So if you think of the big events, track and field, swimming, gymnastics, the things that we traditionally dominate in, we're fourth best among all sports in winning
That's
medals.
Awesome.
So we've got a great history of success.
We're there to take that ride with you guys here at NRA News. We love the stuff we do with you. Before we run out of time, Kevin, how can people get more information about USA Shooting, about this new campaign?
We got to go to the website, usashooting.org. You can also find us on social media at USA Shooting. Let's rally around this idea of shooting is my Olympic sport.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Starts right now. On the program this hour, Gabby Hoffman of Countercultured says the presence of guns on campus carried by lawful legal concealed carry holders would not kill free speech. Plus, Kimberly Corbin, a rape survivor, self-defense advocate, says that Title IX actually makes the case for campus carry, which is an argument that we haven't heard before. She sent a letter to the Maryland General Assembly. And, you know, we have not asked Kimberly to discuss in detail what happened to her. But she told the committee members in this letter. She said, in the early morning hours of May 12, 2006, a stranger broke into my college area apartment, held me in my room for 2 hours, and sexually assaulted me. I had to lay in my bed at 20 years old, completely defenseless, thinking that this was how I was going to die. Kimberly said, I managed to survive my attack, but the damage has already been done. While the police captured my rapist, and he was successfully prosecuted the following year by the Weld County DA's office, the battle against depression, PTSD, and seizures related to the rape had only begun. I returned to school only to be left feeling fearful and exposed. Years later, as a graduate student, I chose to exercise my Second Amendment right by training and lawfully obtaining a permit to carry concealed, including on my college campus of the University of Northern Colorado. Through the help of extensive counseling and the security of my chosen self-defense method, I was able to complete my coursework and earn a degree I may not have otherwise obtained. And she says, Title IX states that no person in the United States shall, on the basis of sex, be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subjected to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. She says, as we're well aware, young college women are at the greatest risk of being sexually assaulted. Campus crimes are an increasing problem across the country. Who are we, she says, to deny college students, faculty, and staff who wish to educate themselves, train, and lawfully carry a concealed firearm on campus from doing so? Clearly, we are willing to do what is necessary to protect ourselves and our peers from harm. Rapists, like the one in my case, Kimberly writes, do not need a weapon to commit their crimes, and those who do use a firearm, we know, completely ignore the imaginary lines called gun-free zones. Do not confuse a false sense of safety due to a ban on concealed carry with actual safety. Which is a fantastic point that Kimberly makes, and again, one that is often overlooked by those covering the campus carry debate or those engaged in the campus carry debate and coming down on the side opposed to campus carry. How many professors have we seen in Texas, for instance, say that they will feel unsafe knowing that a student in their classroom may have a gun once campus carry becomes law? How many of those professors do you think understand that it is currently possible right now for one of their students to legally have a gun in that classroom? I think most of them are probably aware of it on some level, but maybe not. Maybe they really do believe that a policy that declares a campus building to be a gun-free zone will actually be a gun-free zone, that any bad actors would be turned away at the door because of the sign that says you can't bring a gun in here. Maybe they believe it. I don't think they do. I think they probably don't like to think about that possibility. They like that false sense of security that Kimberly talks about. But we'll talk with Kim Corbin coming up in just a few minutes. And in the meantime, the stories of robberies and crimes on campus do continue to show up around the country because we know that our campuses are not crime-free states. Matter of fact, campus robbery suspect caught. Let's see, this was a two separate armed robberies, Daily News Journal. Looks like the fall semester, October 1st, October 2nd of last year, two Middle Tennessee State armed robberies. There's been an arrest. Larry Jones of Covington, Tennessee, also now faces a warrant for an armed robbery last year at Tennessee State University in Nashville, Tennessee. Almost like this guy was targeting college students on a college campus because he knew that they were likely to be defenseless victims. Imagine that. And the fact that those campuses were gun-free zones apparently didn't stop that guy from committing those armed robberies on campus. How about that? Well, again, we'll talk with Kimberly Corbin coming up a little bit later on in the hour. I mentioned we're also continuing to keep our eyes on stories from state houses around the country. In Delaware, a bill that would have prevented this would have prevented the auctioning of firearms by law enforcement. Would have required instead that the firearms be destroyed, was defeated on the floor of the Senate by a vote of 6-15. So there are only 6 votes to overturn the current law in the state of Delaware and require that law enforcement departments destroy these firearms instead of being able to sell them at auction, with the proceeds, again, going to benefit the departments. The only exception would have been firearms with, quote, historical significance. Those could have been allowed to be sold, but only those firearms. But again, that anti-gun bill defeated in Joe Biden's backyard by a vote of 15-6. And in Tennessee, you know, we're keeping our eyes on some campus carry-related bills in a couple of states. One of them is Georgia, where the governor could get campus carry here before long. But another bill, it's not exactly campus carry, but it's more of a parking lot a bill for college campuses. That bill, too, looks like it is making progress in the state of Tennessee and could possibly get to the House for a vote maybe by this week. The House bill is House Bill 2131, the Senate companion measure, which is Senate Bill 1991. That has already passed the Senate. Matter of fact, it passed unanimously in the state of Tennessee just a couple of days ago. I think that was that 29-0 vote that we talked about on Monday's program. So, House bill, the House legislation, House Bill 2131, it's going to the House Calendar and Rules Committee in Tennessee. Once it gets out of that committee, it goes to the House floor for a full vote. So, again, this is parking lot legislation. This basically says that if you, as a concealed carry holder, leave your firearm locked in your vehicle while you were there on campus in a parking lot, you can't be expelled. You can't be fired from your job if you work for the university. No adverse action can be taken against an employee or a student for the lawful transportation and storage of a firearm in that individual's vehicle. Now, again, one might think we wouldn't need legislation like this, but one would be wrong. Because we have seen this before. And we've also seen stories again where, actually in North Carolina we saw this. Saw a student who was a concealed carry holder, who I believe was there on campus, had left their firearm in their car, was doing laundry on campus, parked in a lot, ended up getting arrested, and North Carolina, the lawmakers there actually changed the law after this happened to ensure that individuals could, again, park in these lots and leave their firearms there. But not until this individual had been arrested and I think was actually expelled from the school, not allowed to set foot on the campus of the school. So, again, you know, they're fine going after the law-abiding gun owners. They're happy to deal with those individuals in order to try to ensure that their campuses remain gun-free. The violent criminals, on the other hand, those are a little bit harder to deal with. In that case, you're generally just going to be on your own. And in Ohio, the Democratic primary for the U.S. Senate race, attracting a couple of anti-gun endorsements this week, including, Cameron, you're going to be disappointed in this, I think, maybe, Mark Hamill, Luke Skywalker.
He's been disappointing for a while.
I know, right? Endorsing Cincinnati City Councilman P.G. Sittenfield, who says, I'm more anti-gun than Ted Strickland is. And Mark Hamill came out with his endorsement, said that Sittenfield would be a, quote, very forceful senator on gun control. Yuck, yuck, yuck. Nothing worse than Star Wars puns. So there you go. Mark Hamill says, if you like gun control, vote for that guy. Meanwhile, Gabrielle Giffords has come out in favor of Ted Strickland, the other Democratic candidate there, as, again, both candidates trying to out anti-gun one another. I'll be honest with you. I'm not sure how much the endorsement of a celebrity, again, likely protected by all kinds of armed security. Kevin, just out of curiosity, you think of like a Comic-Con or some sort of event like that. You think Mark Hamill has security with him?
At Comic-Con this year, probably yes. Walking down the street in whatever town he lives in, you know, probably not on a daily basis.
You think he walks down the street in town he lives in?
Well, come on. Honestly, Cam, do you really think people stop Mark Hamill? I think a few, enough for security.
Would. I just don't think he walks. I think he probably has like a land speeder that he uses.
Like one of the props, and it's like the Flintstones. He actually uses his feet.
Exactly. Just pedals that thing. I'm guessing in dealing with the public that Mark Hamill is one of those celebrities who has some folks around who are there to make sure that he is okay. And you know what? Again, I don't have a problem with that at all. Most of us can't afford that, right? Most of us cannot afford our own private security detail. Most of us, when we show up for our, you know, company award ceremony or whatever, there's not hundreds of law enforcement and private security guards making sure that we're going to be okay, like they have at the Oscars. Our lives are a little bit different, and that's okay. What's not okay is when you have somebody who benefits, again, from other people who are there getting paid to make sure that they go home safe at the end of the night, when those folks say, you don't get to choose how to defend yourself. As a matter of fact, I get to choose how you defend yourself. Don't fall for the Jedi mind trick. It won't end well. Kimberly Corbin, rape survivor and self-defense advocate, is going to join us on the program. Why don't we take a quick time out? We will be back with much more NRA News Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Jim Sapieha, director of the NRA Museums. Jim, there's three museums. Let's talk about that third museum you guys have way out west.
That third museum is kind of a little hidden jewel box. It doesn't get the press that the other two bigger museums get, but it's a spectacular little display case. It's the Frank Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and it's at the NRA Whittington Center in Raton, New Mexico. Now, folks who are really shooters will know what the Whittington Center is, but those who may not be that active, it's a spectacular range and hunting complex that is owned and operated by the NRA. There are tens of thousands of acres out there with spectacular ranges where a lot of different championship matches are shot in addition to general recreational and sporting shooting. But they also have the Brownell Museum of the Southwest, and they have some great guns there. Of course, history of that area is just spectacular, going back to the conquistadors. And they follow the evolution of firearms in that area throughout that multiple century span. They also have firearms that are used in the types of competitions that take place at the Whittington Center. And they recently got a spectacular group of modern engraved firearms. There are masterworks there that I have never seen the likes of before. So if you're in that area, and it's a great area for vacationing, there's a lot of attractions in that area, be sure you don't miss this little jewel box of a museum there.
And how do you get to see all the museums online?
Well, you can. We have several social media platforms. We've got, of course, the website, nramuseums.com. And, of course, we have our Facebook page. You can friend us there and get our Gun of the Day posts. So you can visit us on the Internet, Facebook, get the books. And for sure, come by and see the three museums. They're all open every day of the week, and admission is always free.
I'm a good person. I never bothered anybody. But I can't afford a nice house in a safe neighborhood. I live in a government high-rise. Gangbangers and drug dealers walk down our halls every day. My neighbors and I were scared. We called the police, but they can't keep us safe. Some of us are too afraid to even leave our apartments. But the housing authority told me if I bought a gun to protect myself, they'd throw me to the streets. If I'm not free because of my address today, what makes you think you'll be free tomorrow? I marched behind Martin Luther King at Selma. I know my rights. Now I have my gun. I am the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
What kind of government cares more about appeasing Islamic terrorists than defending the constitutional rights of its citizens? A government that would disarm us during the age of terror. Nothing would make us more vulnerable to generations of suffering and slaughter than the destruction of our Second Amendment. But many of our politicians, aided by a relentless media, are launching that attack themselves. They dream of joining the rest of the disarmed peoples of the world, entrusting our survival to the mercy of monsters. The greatest damage the terrorists could ever inflict upon us is disarmament at the hands of the political elites. But we will never offer our right to survive as a fool's ransom to the world's killers. Our freedom is what they fear most. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Welcome back. Hour two of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, starts right now. Gabby Hoffman, coming up in just a little bit, says the presence of firearms on campus will not kill free speech. Frankly, again, there's no trouble killing free speech on college campuses. Right now, in many gun-free zones, we are seeing free speech die an ugly death. I want to welcome to the program right now Kimberly Corbin, rape survivor, self-defense advocate. Kimberly, thank you for coming on the program today.
Thanks for having me on, Cam.
It's good to talk to you as always. It was a fantastic seeing you in D.C. And I've got to ask you, I know we interviewed you right after that panel discussion on firearms in America, but Looking back, can you think of like a couple of the questions that you got? Did you get a question that you just thought was a fantastic question from an audience member?
Well, I especially liked when everyone was introducing themselves and one gentleman stood up and said his name and he just identified himself as a taxpayer. But one of the questions that was really great was actually from a current college student asking a little bit more about what you can do on your college campuses to make sure that your right to concealed carry is protected. And as we know, this is a daily fight, especially right now, because we have so many gun grabbers that are actively working to disarm students, to disarm faculty. So campus carry is this huge issue. My friend that I work with and I have been kicking around this idea because in the sex assault advocacy world, one of the big things that we hear so much about is Title IX issues with our federally funded college universities. For people that aren't familiar with Title IX, this is the gender equality passage that is coming up on its 40th anniversary here. And it just says basically that if you are going to accept any kind of federal funding, that you have to make sure that you are ensuring gender equality and that everyone has the right to pursue higher education regardless of your gender. The big thing with this in the sexual assault advocacy world is that there's so many rape survivors that are on campus or attending school to receive a higher education, and because schools are not dealing appropriately with their sex assault concerns or their reports or expelling students, that they have this increased fear or inability to keep going to those classes or to educate themselves the way that they need to be.
Mm-hmm.
So Title IX is this huge, huge issue, but it rarely intersects with self-defense. And that's why we're thinking, well, why is that the case? I am a rape survivor. And when I went back to grad school, I chose to educate myself, to train, and to carry a concealed firearm because that was what made me the most safe, because I knew that if I was presented with that kind of issue again, that that's how I would want to confront it. Under Title IX, shouldn't that say that my ability to choose the way that I am defending myself should be respected just as it is respected that the university is going to make as many, put in as many safety measures as possible to protect mm-hmm. me? Why can't I protect myself?
You know, so let me try to play devil's advocate here for a second.
Yes.
Kimberly, look, these anti-gun positions that we have, these gun-free zones on college campuses, they're not aimed at depriving women of the right to self-defense. They're aimed at ensuring that our campuses remain safe so that nobody, men or women, are carrying around toting guns on campus and into buildings and whatnot.
Right. You know, so if you have these gun-free zones, the only people that are going to be carrying in these areas are law enforcement and criminals. So these people that are choosing to conceal carry, while it is still available to us, we're not trying to arm every student. We're trying to keep every student's right to choose their form of personal protection intact.
All right. Well, I can't argue with that.
Right. Well, and the big thing at the end of the day is that those of us that choose to carry, we're trained. We take it seriously. We know our laws and our regulations, and we don't carry just to keep ourselves safe. We're doing so knowing that we may be called upon to protect our peers as well.
And so you wrote a letter to the Maryland General Assembly, right, because they're taking up House Bill 1002.
Mm-hmm.
A campus carry issue, and you know, I'll confess, it's not likely to pass in Maryland, unfortunately. But you wrote lawmakers, and you explained what happened to you. You told them about the crime that was committed, and you explained to them, when you went back to college. I thought this was really interesting. When you went back to college, that you did carry a firearm, and you lived in a state in which that was the law of the land, right? I mean,
yeah.
In Colorado at the time, since 2003, I know that the University of Colorado tried to prohibit a concealed carry on campus for a number of years, but every other state school said okay, and so you were able to carry. Was that an issue for any of the faculty members or staff members? Did you have people, an influx of students or faculty leave the school there because people like you were lawfully and legally carrying on campus?
No, and that is the beauty of it. Our First Amendment rights are protecting our Second Amendment rights, and for those of us that are carrying, it's concealed. That's the best part. You don't know that it's concealed. But in 2013, when Colorado legislators tried to ban campus carry, then you had people all up in arms, not necessarily realizing, but hey, guys, for the last 10 years, we have been doing this, and you have not heard of one incident, not one, but fear-mongering was a very, very real thing at that point.
Absolutely. I mean, there were the lawmakers were full of hypotheticals about, you know, what could happen with something that had been in place for 10 years. And yet they didn't want to consider, Kimberly, at the time, they didn't want to consider the reality of what had happened to people like you and Amanda Collins.
Yep.
And they didn't want to hear that. Right.
No. Well, and in this letter, I actually cite the ACLU, which is, you know, their bread and butter. But they issued a report that said when students suffer sexual assault and harassment, they are deprived of equal and free access to an education. If my carrying a firearm levels that playing field, which is what they're all about, is this gender equality, obviously, if that's what it takes to level that playing field and make sure that I can still sit in my college classrooms and know that I am safe because I have taken the measures to protect myself from this happening again, how is it that they can just pick and choose what is going to be protected and what isn't?
Talking again with Kimberly Corbin, was there any reaction to this letter being read last night? Did anybody, any lawmaker in Maryland acknowledge this?
You know, not that I know of yet. I haven't gotten any feedback from my point of contact there, but we did publish it on Bearing Arms as well. And it's funny, the people that have actually reacted to it have said, you know, either that they were waiting for this argument or why hasn't this point been made before? If you just, I mean, do a simple Google search, Title IX comes up in mass, and it is a lot related to sex assault, victimization, harassment, stalking, domestic violence, all of these things that we're trying to protect our college students from. Why are we trying to take away the ability to put the tools that they need to protect themselves out of their hands?
Based on the arguments that we're hearing, Kimberly, I think it's because the opponents don't think that you were responsible enough to carry a firearm.
That's exactly what I'm hearing. I'm hearing that I am an adult in every capacity, and I can pay these thousands of dollars worth of student loans and make all of these adult decisions. But when it comes to how I'm going to protect myself, well, that's not actually okay.
Sure.
Have you seen the CNN documentary Hunting Ground?
I've seen portions of it.
Okay. So they address Title IX quite extensively in that documentary. And if anybody gets a chance, I highly suggest looking at it because really – the survivors that come forward in that hour and a half show or so are phenomenal. And I took so much away from watching that. More so, what I'm seeing is that their rapists were allowed to stay on campus, that the universities did nothing to protect them, and that sometimes those students were the ones that had to leave themselves because they were left so unprotected. And here we have a constitutional right that they're saying, well, you know, bring your First Amendment rights all you want, as long as they're aligning with our goals, but your Second Amendment rights, check them at our imaginary gun-free zone line.
Well, you know, I mean, again, look at Amanda Collins' story, right?
Yep.
So after she was sexually assaulted, then the president of the university told her, okay, you can carry your firearm, but don't tell anybody, right? Don't tell any other female students, even though this guy is still on the loose right now. Don't tell anybody because they might also want to carry a firearm for self-defense, and we really don't want that.
Right. Amanda Collins is a great friend of mine, actually. We've worked together on a few different projects, and to hear her talk about how this president wanted to keep her Second Amendment right concealed and to keep it quiet. You know, we don't carry these in the first place because we're wanting to brandish and tell everybody that, hey, well, guess what I've got in my backpack or, you know, on my belt or whatever. That's not what we're doing here. But why is it that something has to happen before they take action, before they allow these kinds of students that are training to carry?
Absolutely. And you know, and even then that response from the university president seemed to indicate, Amanda, I'm trying to appease you, but I don't necessarily want other female students carrying a firearm for self-defense.
Right, because God forbid people that are not criminals have the tools in their hands to equalize them against a larger attacker. But at the end of the day, rapists do not need a gun to rape. But if we want to fend them off with certainty, we sure as heck need the ability to choose how we're going to defend ourselves.
And that's really what it comes down to, you, isn't it, Kimberly? You're not demanding that everybody make the same choice that you made. You're not demanding that everybody go out and become a gun owner and a concealed carry holder. But you want people to have that choice.
Yeah, and that, bringing it back to CPAC and one of the questions somebody had asked, why isn't the NRA giving guns to all of these inner city single moms to protect themselves from the looting and rioting? That's not what we're trying to do. I have never once said that I want everyone to have a gun, because quite honestly, I don't. If you have a fear of firearms, or if you aren't doing the proper training, or you aren't, or if you're just ignoring the laws that it takes to carry concealed, I don't want you to have a firearm. I want people who are diligent about their training, who understand the gravity that comes with their Second Amendment rights, and those who are going to stand up if I'm somewhere and I need a citizen that maybe has their firearm, if for some unforeseen reason I didn't, those are the people I want having guns in their hands, not just your everyday student that's walking around. And I think that's honestly what the left loves to push, is that we're trying to arm everyone. It's not the case at all.
No, and, look, clearly not everybody is going to make that choice.
No.
Right?
No.
This is what I don't understand, that there is – on the campus carry issue, there is such an unwillingness to actually look at what has happened in states like Colorado, where we have seen these laws on the books for a long period of time. And I mentioned this. We were talking with Antonio Okafor a couple of weeks ago, and I said, it's fascinating because we have all these professors who are they're leaving in Texas, right? Or one of them is going to Australia. The other one's going to University of Pennsylvania. They're saying, I'm out of here. We've got students saying, I'm not going to go to campus there. And yet, none of that happened in Utah. None of that happened in Colorado. I'm wondering why the great freakout is happening now.
Well, have you seen our mainstream media and what they report? I mean,
are you saying, Kimberly, that our media likes a narrative here and is maybe encouraging this?
No, but I mean, it's much harder to report on stories where these kinds of attacks are thwarted because of a good guy with a gun, and they won't get near as much attraction as the mass shootings and, blaming the gun instead of the person. It's, again, it's a mental health issue. And if they are going to commit a crime, they're going to do it with whatever means necessary. Taking guns out of law-abiding citizens, and in this case students' hands, is not going to stop anything. My local, or alma mater, actually, has 16 officers right now with their department. Mind you, there's a chief and an investigator, and there's two on patrol, and that is 24/7 to over 12,000 students. So you're telling me if you take away our right to concealed carry, that those 16 officers, because they are completely human, are going to be around when I need them? Am I supposed to rely on the call box that's out of order? Or how about that handy rape whistle? Let me tell you how handy that would have come in the case of my assault.
Well, look, here's the thing. If you're telling somebody use a rape whistle or use a tongue depressor, what you are telling them is, I think that you do have the right to defend yourself. I just want to limit the tools that you have available to defend yourself.
I don't want to come off as victim blaming when you actually get raped, but I just want to make sure that, I did what I felt was okay to say that you can defend yourself. That's victim blaming. Don't pigeonhole us and say that we can't protect ourselves. We have Joe Salazar from this very state that's saying that we may pop off at somebody and not know if that person's really going to rape us. Are you kidding me? Give me a break. I knew what was happening to me. That wasn't somebody that I was going to just shoot because, he's kind of lurking behind me. That is the last means of defense that we want to take.
It's weird that Cosmo didn't feature that statement as an example of gunsplaining, did they?
Shocker.
Yeah, that is a real shocker. Well... Listen, Kimberly, again, I can't thank you enough for what you do. Your voice is so important, and I got to tell you, we always love having you on the program.
Well, thanks so much, Cam. I hope that this is an argument that people can start looking a little more into and educating themselves on exactly what Title IX should mean.
I think it's a fantastic line of argument in favor of campus carry, and I hope you get a genuine, legitimate response. I hope what doesn't happen is I hope you don't it's just ignored and people don't want to pick up this argument and respond to it.
Right, and I want to know if this is completely out of bounds and Title IX does not apply to my right to defend myself. then tell me how I can, because that's something that we need to pursue even harder.
Absolutely. Kimberly, thank you again. We'll be talking again very soon.
Great. Talk to you soon, Cam.
Kimberly Corbin joining us here on NRA News, Cam and Company. Meanwhile, in East Lansing, Michigan, police are seeking two men in connection with an armed robbery of a Michigan State University student near campus back on the morning of March the 4th. It was about 5 o'clock in the morning. 19-year-old student walking west on the north sidewalk of Grand River Avenue when he was approached by a man near a bus stop. The Lansing State Journal reports. Suspect asked to use the student's cell phone to call a cab. The suspect then showed a handgun, demanded the phone, told the victim to run away and not look back. Huh. Interesting. No arrests have been made. But it's almost, again, like this criminal knew that that student was not likely to have a firearm on him. And again, we see these stories all the time on college campuses around the country. Matter of fact, the Instapundit, Glenn Reynolds, had a post earlier today talking about his daughter, who, while a freshman at Georgia Tech, experienced a number of assaults. The entire campus experienced a number of armed robberies there on the campus. He said, when his daughter was a freshman, he wrote the university president personally because armed gangs were staging dorm invasions, breaking into dorms, and robbing students at gunpoint. Glenn said, I was concerned about her safety, but I didn't even get a reply. He said, that makes me wonder if one reason why the Tech administration is targeting its own students is its inability to deal with the actual serious crime on and around its campus. See, there's a lawmaker in Georgia who thinks that the president of Georgia Tech should resign because of the lack of due process that is afforded students who are accused of sexual assaults. One individual, and this lawmaker's state representative, Earl Earhart, who had a hearing back in January, heard from the mother of a male student accused of sexual misconduct. The young man let his female friend stay in his apartment while she waited for her roommate to return to their dorm because she had lost her keys. The young woman had been drinking. The young man kept her safe at his apartment. Sometime later, apparently after the fact, a friend of the young woman accused the young man of holding this young woman against her will. Text messages from the young woman thanking the young man for allowing her to stay at his place while she waited were not allowed to be used in the young man's disciplinary hearing. The young woman herself, the supposed victim, said, I'm not a victim. There was no problem here. But because of the accusation of the third party, this student was suspended from school. Another male student was expelled after he rebuffed the advances of another male student. That student was eventually reinstated by the school's Board of Regents after the student filed a lawsuit. So these are the types of things that the university apparently is taking very seriously. But things like armed gangs staging dorm invasions, a parent of a student complains to the university president, doesn't even get a response back. It's this bizarre banana republic justice on a lot of these college campuses where real crimes like sexual assault are encouraged to be thought of not as actual crimes that need to be reported to the police, but as something that can be handled administratively there on campus, where real crimes like assault and robbery are downplayed and ignored so that the line, the company line of our campuses are incredibly safe places to be, can continue to be stated. And in the meantime, the people who are responsible for paying the salaries of these university presidents, again, these students, the parents of these students, the individuals who are working, they're the staff level on these universities are subjected to this absurd parody of justice. Glenn also said when it came to Georgia Tech, he also felt that they really lied to them about the campus security situation when they were looking at the place. And he said, I would advise future applicants and parents of applicants to take whatever they say with a grain of salt. Well, lawmakers in Georgia are also looking at passing a campus carry bill, which would allow some modicum of safety to those concealed carry holders who were students and faculty there at Georgia Tech. All right, when we come back, Gabby Hoffman from Counterculture, writing in Town Hall, says the presence of firearms on college campuses will not kill free speech. Again, they're doing a pretty good job of that right now. Stick around. There's more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this. Here at the Great American Outdoor Show at the Pennsylvania Farm Show Complex in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. And Teresa Vail is with us. How are you, Teresa?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am excellent. Love the shirt, by the way.
Thank you. I feel like I'm all NRA'd out with the coat and the shirt.
Right.
Got to represent.
Are you having a good time here at the Great American
Outdoor
Show?
This is actually my first year here. You know, I'm used to SHOT Show and the NRA convention. This is a new ball game. There are tons of people here. I didn't expect that.
Yeah, and this is huge, too.
Yeah,
it's massive.
The complex is amazing.
And it's really interesting because, you know, you mentioned SHOT Show and the NRA annual meeting, and these are both, you know, events that you'll get anywhere from 50 to 80,000 mm-hmm. attendees. Mm-hmm. We're looking at somewhere around 200,000
people. That's what they said.
Here.
I know. Walking through the halls of this place is nuts. It is chaos.
And for 9 days, you know, we get these crowds, which really shows you, I think, just how popular the outdoor sports and the world of the outdoors really, truly is in this country.
I was going to touch on that. That's what I love about these conventions, about these trade shows. This one especially, because it brings together like-minded individuals. You know, everybody here, you know that they're supporters of the NRA, probably, or they love hunting, they love the outdoors. It's like-minded. You're with people who think and feel that the way you do.
Absolutely. So let's talk a little bit. For those who haven't had a chance to really get to know you, what's your background? How did you get into the world of hunting and shooting?
My dad started me hunting when I was 10. Bow hunting is what I really prefer to do. I didn't get into that until about three, four years ago.
And all of a sudden you you love it.
I'm drawn to it because of the intimacy. You know, instead of being 150 yards or 200 yards away from an animal, you need to be, you know, 30, 40 yards, perhaps even closer. So I like that up and close personal feel to it. And I think it gives you that much more respect for the animal. But you know, there's still a time and place for guns. I prefer guns for protection, for personal defense. I carry. I love going to the range.
You don't want to use a compound bow for personal defense? That's not your preferred choice?
I don't think I'd be as quick on it. Have you seen the TV show Arrow?
I have.
Okay, so that's what comes to mind.
Right.
You know, he's a badass with a bow, but
we can't all be superheroes.
But we can't all be superheroes as much as I would like to be, and I try to be.
Right. Yeah. And so tell me, because you've had the opportunity to go and do some incredible hunts and visit some incredible places, the people that you talk to and that you're involved with in these hunts, is that as important to you as the game that you're actually going after?
I think hunting, there are two aspects to it. It can be very, very personal, and then it can be very, very social. The dichotomy, I think, is what makes it so fascinating. I like the social aspect because we can go out pheasant hunting, and while you're pheasant hunting, you get to joke around and talk, and you don't have to be hush-hush. It's very social and lively. But then that other side of it is you can be in the tree stand alone by yourself for hours and just have that solitude and peacefulness. And that's what I prefer. I'm a lone wolf. It's what I prefer. But the dichotomy of it is fascinating, and I do love both aspects.
You know, and in this modern connected world, too, I think it's so important to have those moments where you are disconnected. And it's you and the tree stand and nature, and, you know, there's that focus, but there's also that ability to just sort of let all of that other stuff go, right?
I couldn't agree more. And that's my peaceful place. So everybody knows the Serenity tattoo that I have. And I got that because of my feelings for the woods. The woods gave that peacefulness to me. You know, when Dad started taking me out when I was 10, there are no cell phones. There, you can bring a book, sure, but you're still disconnected from the internet, from the age of social media, which I hate. There's a time and place for it, but I do hate it.
Yeah.
And you're away from that, and you get to focus on what's really important.
Absolutely. So tell me about what you have going on now with all of your, again, it is an interconnected world, and we get a chance to watch you on TV.
Yes.
We get a chance to watch you on NRANews.com.
Yeah.
I can't even keep up with everything you're doing.
I can't even keep up with everything I'm doing. We just wrapped up filming season 5 of NRA All Access. I hosted season 5. We're now moving on to season 6 of NRA All Access, and that's on Outdoor Channel Wednesdays at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time.
Okay.
And we're just coming up with new ideas for season 6, moving into season 6. Season 5 was incredible. We went to Italy and hunted pheasants there and toured the Franchi shotgun factory and saw the intense history behind it. So I'm looking forward to season 6 and what it brings.
Thanks again for being a part of this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. I think I am almost over the CPAC crud, thankfully. Now, it was not cruddy at all. It was actually fantastic to get a chance to see our next guest at the Conservative Political Action Conference. Gabriella Hoffman is with us. Writing this time at Town Hall. Gabby, how you doing today?
Happy Wednesday. I'm doing well.
Excellent.
Thankful not to have the CPAC plug. Are you feeling better?
I am. I don't want to jinx anything. I'm going to knock on my knock on wood. But, I kind of thought that this would be a lingering cruddiness. But it does appear to have only lasted a couple of days. And good for you for avoiding it. I thought I was going to get off scot-free and then... Yeah, Sunday I thought, uh-oh, no, I didn't. I came down with something.
Aww.
I know. But it was still a fantastic time. It was absolutely great seeing you there. And you've got a piece, as I said.
Great to see you there.
What's that?
It was very good seeing you there, yes.
Well, it's always, this is nice because it's one of the few times that, everybody's so busy doing their own thing that, it's nice when we can all come together at things like the NRA annual meeting or at CPAC and actually get a chance to see each other face to face for a few minutes. And this is something, I know it's a huge issue right now. We were just talking with Kimberly Corbin a couple minutes ago about campus carry. But you've got your piece at Town Hall right now. The presence of guns on campus won't kill free speech. This is a big argument from campus carry opponents right now. You talk about a column in the Atlantic of Furman de Brabender, who's a professor in Maryland. He says that, quote, campus carry will make students and faculty less inclined to engage in the critical intellectual work that must take place in the classroom. I fear that campus carry will make students and faculty less inclined to engage in the critical intellectual work, the courageous inquiry and experimentation that American democracy requires. It'll be chilled because there are concealed carry holders there in class, Gabby.
That's the most ludicrous argument to make from someone who claims to be a free speech advocate. And in his articles, How Guns Could Censor College Classrooms, it's the most ironic thing, coming from a guy who's projecting his anti-gun bias and more so authoritarian beliefs. But it's just a dangerous argument that he's proposing. Campus carry advocates, given all their knowledge and the training that they've acquired and completed, they're the most well-read people. They're very attentive to details. They pay attention, and they're the least prone to commit acts of violence. And so just him accusing them of that is a very dangerous argument for him to make.
I do think it shows the good professor's ignorance on the issue here, because as you note, concealed carry holders far more law abiding than the general population. These are individuals who have made that conscious decision to acquire a concealed carry license. They can carry for self-defense. Mm-hmm. I think that these are the individuals who, as you say, Gabby, these are the least likely to get angry and whip out their firearm. That doesn't happen off campus. I don't know why it would happen on campus.
Yeah, people like de Brabender like to create safe spaces for themselves where they think that they're promoting free speech, but they're promoting the exact opposite. And he's obviously very triggered by concealed carry proponents and activists who would actually engage him very peaceably if presented with the opportunity. So it's just very, very discouraging that someone who claims to be a proponent of free speech is pushing the exact opposite.
You know, it's interesting, too, because The Atlantic a couple of days ago had a piece by Connor Friedersdorf, The Glaring Evidence That Free Speech Is Threatened on Campus. And what's weird is that he didn't even mention campus carry, Gabby. He talked about the things that are actually taking place on college campuses right now that are actually infringing on freedom of speech and really, you know, freedom of expression. We were just talking about this earlier in the show at USC. One of the student senators who invited Milo Yiannopoulos to speak there on campus is now the subject of an impeachment effort because he invited Milo Yiannopoulos to speak at USC. That apparently showed such horrible judgment that he cannot be allowed to remain in his position there in student government. And that's a fairly benign example of the targeting of speech that we've seen on campus.
That's correct. With this example, with this particular professor, he wants to stifle Second Amendment speech. And any student who chooses to organize in a campus carry group or a Second Amendment group, I've seen in my work, you know, outside of blogging, students there have encountered so many roadblocks to even forming a club on campus. And people like this individual writing in The Atlantic are trying to prevent them from having a voice. Instead of adding more voices, they're subtracting more voices, especially pro-gun voices. And it's very disconcerting to see that take place at an American university.
So you say you've talked with students who say we're trying to form a Students for Concealed Carry chapter or a pro Second Amendment group on campus, and our administrators are putting up roadblocks. They're making it difficult for us to do that.
Yes, I've seen it with many groups. Some in Massachusetts. Most recently with a case with a group I was working with in Delaware, for instance, and this is probably very true for other clubs across the country, too, but they have won the privilege to have $500 of student fees appropriated for bullet purchases, and they got that approved. And then most recently I saw that that was rescinded because so many people complained and said it's going to, you know, infringe their freedom and infringe their livelihood on campus. So it's pretty ridiculous that even when administrators kind of make the inroads towards so-called being receptive towards free speech or at least alternative views, they backtrack and they side with people who despise free speech or despise the Second Amendment perspective on campus.
You know, and isn't it interesting? I mean, here you have at least one professor who I don't know that Furman de Brabender has written a lot about the real threats, or I guess maybe what he would say, the other threats to a free speech on campus. But when you're inventing these problems that haven't existed when campus carry have gone into effect in other states, and you are ignoring the real problems that currently exist on college campuses. What do you call that, Gabby? Is that something that an educated person would do? I mean, it seems to me like that's not engaging your critical thinking skills that that you should have as a professor at an institution of higher learning.
I would say that de Brabender is living in a fantasy world. Clearly, because he glosses over the fact, like he wrote an article in the Baltimore Sun saying protect life, limit access to guns. You would think he'd be a commonsensical person. I mean, being a professor, very intellectual, supposedly knows better than all the rest of us plebeians in society. And he just does not have any common sense, judging by his articles and judging by what he puts out there, what he disseminates to his audience. He just propagates, you know, virulent anti-gun rhetoric and writing samples. I don't see any common sense among them. He's very hung up and very triggered by the rise of how popular the Second Amendment is. People taking it to defend themselves, find means to defend themselves, and especially students who want to help protect any outset of attacks on in the classroom. You know, if that were to happen, he's triggered by them more so than he is triggered by criminals. That's very disconcerting and very, very troubling to see.
Absolutely. Gabby, listen, it is always a pleasure having you on the program. Unfortunately, we've got to run. We're almost up against a hard break here, but I know we'll be talking again soon. And thanks for what
Absolutely.
You do.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You bet.
As
Gabby
always.
Hoffman joining us. Writing, you can usually catch her at Counterculture, but her latest column, again, at Town Hall, The Presence of Guns on Campus Won't Kill Free Speech. Connor Friedersdorf at The Atlantic, writing about the glaring evidence that free speech is threatened on campus, said in 2015 alone, this is a partial list here, by the way, it's not even a complete list, Robin Steinberg was disinvited from Harvard Law School. The rapper Common was disinvited from Keene University. Suzanne Vinker was disinvited from Williams College. Asra Nomani addressed Duke University only after student attempts to cancel her speech were overturned. UC Berkeley Chancellor Nicholas Dirks participated in an event on his own campus that student protesters shut down. Speakers at USC needed police to intervene to continue an event. Angela Davis was subject to a petition that attempted to prevent her from speaking at Texas Tech. The rapper Big Sean faced a student effort to get him disinvited from Princeton. Bob McCullough faced a student effort to disinvite him from speaking at St. Louis University. William Ayers was a subject to an effort to disinvite him from the Dickinson School of Law. Harold Coe faced a student effort to oust him as a visiting professor at New York University Law School. As Friedersdorf says, the list includes speakers from the left and the right. It really does seem that on campus, again, there is the intolerance of tolerance is not just an acceptable line of thinking. It is the line of thinking that one must adhere to. Again, you can say you're all in favor of a diversity of ideas and a diversity of viewpoints, and you're interested in being challenged intellectually. You want to hear from people that disagree with because it helps you think about your own positions. You can say that all you want. But that's not what we see on college campuses right now. And because most of this pressure, not all of it, but most of this pressure is coming from I think groups on the left, you are seeing this directed largely at anybody who could be considered remotely on the right. But again, that's not always the case. Folks across the political spectrum being silenced because of what they think and want to say. Stick around. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, is coming up right after this quick timeout.
Here with Ashley Levinsky. She is the curator of the Cody Firearms Museum. Ashley, good to see you again, and thanks for being back on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Now, last time when we talked to you, our good friend Phil Schreier was here. He's not here this time, so I have you all to myself.
Oh, yeah, we don't have any guns today.
I know, that's okay. We'll talk all about the museum. It's such a cool place, and you're such a great representative of the Cody Firearms Museum. So tell folks, what is the Cody Firearms Museum?
Oh, man. The Cody Firearms Museum is actually it's one of five major museums at the Buffalo Bill Center of the West, and we also have a huge research library. And there are guns in every single museum. But the Cody Firearms Museum has 7,000 firearms. And they start all the way back to 1425, and they go up through modern day. And so there's literally something for every interest. We've got, obviously, the American West guns being in Cody, Wyoming. But then we've also got an extensive military history collection, embellished arms collection, Hollywood guns, you name it, it's there.
And I love, Ashley, how there's such an integral part of American history, how you can tell the history of the country through its firearms, starting all the way from 1425. Yeah, all the way up. It's so great.
Well, you know, it's so interesting to me, because when we got our start, you know, we were the Winchester Arms Museum, and that came from the Winchester Collection, which was loaned and then donated to us. But it was always, you know, so much more than just, you know, the American West. I mean, the American Western story just was international to the Winchester Company, and so they collected international firearms, they collected historic firearms that predated Winchester, obviously, with 1425, and so, you know, they recognized how important this firearm story was all over the world and how it impacted the American West, and so it's amazing that you could literally take one firearm and just tell so many different stories.
And you guys are going to tell, like my good friend Phil Schreier, we always say, if that firearm could only talk.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
And what would it say? So when you guys get together with Phil and your other curators, you know, we've got 7,000 firearms. Well, I got 10,000. You guys ever get into any contests or anything?
Yeah, it's usually more like, oh, you got that gun? You want to loan it over here? Loan that one?
It's like a poker game.
It really is. But, you know, what's so great is that I love that the museums really complement each other. I mean, they've got some... I actually had to laugh. I went down to the NRA Museum's booth, you know.
Right.
And they had... Right now, they're displaying one of Eisenhower guns and one of JFK's guns. Well, so are we. And I was like, we did not plan that at all.
I love it. That's so great. Well, you know, so tell folks some of the most compelling stories and stories about some of the firearms you have. So stuff that's really piqued your interest.
You know, I'll talk about the first gun that I worked on back 5 years ago when I first came to the Cody Firearms Museum. And it was a Colt 1861 Navy, and it was serial number one.
Of course. That always helps.
Yeah, original leather holster. And, you know, first off, I mean, you know the 61's great, and it's got this great history, but, you know, it was one of 100 made with a fluted cylinder, so it had that kind of rarity to it. And then it also, we knew who it belonged to. And not only did we know who it belonged to, it wasn't given to, like, a general or something. It was a private who happened to buy it. It was made on April 9th. They actually wrote the date underneath the strap. And so it was April 9th, 1861, and his name was Caleb Slate. And Caleb Slate enlisted in the American Civil War in, I think, May 20th or 21st of that year. And so he just happened across number one.
Wow.
And the fact that we can then trace that gun through the American Civil War, and then the history kind of gets fuzzy until it ended up at an auction. Someone bought it and then put it on loan to us. And to me, to see one, a significant model, you know, with its own technological history, but then you have the military side of it, and then to find an actual soldier and a personal connection to it, just doesn't get much better.
Awesome. How can you get more information about the museum?
All right. Well, you can go to thecenterofthewest.org. You can actually read about all five of our museums, and we're at Cody Firearms on Twitter.
Ashley, thank you so much for being on NRA News.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome back. Hour three of NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Starts right now. On the program this hour, Robbie Sawabi of Reason, writing in the Daily Beast about the college that wants to ban history. They also want to change the spelling of it as well. Western Washington University, their student activist community. Robbie says it's the frightening sounding Assembly for Power and Liberation. Uh-huh. They've made a list of demands. Yep. Their demands include, you will take us seriously. They also want a brand new college, new College of Power and Liberation. Which kind of sounds like where the Super Friends went to school, doesn't it, Cameron? Like, I was in statistics with the Wonder Twins at the College of Power and Liberation.
All I want to play is that sound in the middle of segments now.
That might throw Robbie off. Otherwise, I'd say do it, but that might throw Robbie off a little bit. Immediately want to hire 10 faculty members subject to the approval of the student activists. We will decide who will teach us. We will approve who will educate us. Yeah, I think part of the problem here is the idea that when you, at least when I went to college, the idea was that you were there to learn, right? That you, in fact, did not know everything that there was to know. And, in fact, you were paying money so that you could get an education. Now it seems almost like the script has been flipped, and now we're paying good money here to educate you, professors. That's not how it works. Someone, I think, should have explained that a little bit better. But anyway, we'll talk with Robbie about it later on in the hour. Kurt Schlichter, author of Conservative Insurgency, will join us as well. Right now, though, let's get to our hero of the day, deal of the day, our good guy of the day. And we will start, with our hero of the day, sponsored by AdCore Defense, just as soon as my computer wants to start working again, we can get to our hero of the day. From WNCN. This was actually from KTLA in Torrance, California. They report an allegedly armed man who attempted to rob a jewelry store in Torrance fatally shot by the store's owner on Tuesday. Torrance Police Department spokesman Sergeant Paul Cranky said the store owner fired on an individual who was trying to rob the store, Lanai's Jewelers? Leilani's Jewelers? The business owner said the man had been armed, According to Sergeant Paul Cranky, a gun believed to be the robbery suspect was found at the scene. Friends and customers of the store came to the scene, according to KTLA, saying that they were concerned for the owner. Friend Garfield Estes says he's a really nice guy. He's a nice, soft-spoken guy. But push comes to shove, he'll take care of himself. Customer said the door needed to be buzzed open from the inside in order for potential buyers to enter. We'll keep following that story and give you more details as they become available. But again, right now it looks like a case of self-defense there in Torrance, California. And it's you know, despite all of the anti-gun laws that politicians try to put on the books there in California, so far they have not succeeded in actually outlawing defending yourself with a firearm. Although they'll, I'm sure they'd love to try. Give them time. They do want to make it as difficult as possible for you to be able to do so there in California. Now, our deals of the day. I mentioned we had an update from an earlier deal. Okemudi Omadi from Nigeria up in Dover, New Hampshire. Back in court, he had a bail hearing on Monday. He is charged with a robbery back on December 29th in Farmington, New Hampshire. Charged with shoving a man to the ground. Appeared to be holding a deadly weapon. He allegedly stole money, cigarettes, and clothing from the victim. On Monday at this bail hearing, Mr. Omadi's attorney, Emily Roberts, asked the judge to release Omadi from jail on personal recognizance or surety bail. Said that Omadi could be safely supervised by his mother there in Dover, New Hampshire, if he was released from jail. She said he's not a danger to society. He's being held on this one thing because of a person with credibility issues. In other words, he's not a bad guy. He's got this one charge that he's facing. You know what? The victim's got some credibility issues here. So just let him out. His mom will watch him. The Union Leader reports County Attorney Thomas Velarde responded that Omadi has a tendency to reoffend when he's released back into the community. And he asked that bail remain at a pretty low $5,000 cash. Judge ultimately decided to keep Omadi behind bars on cash-only bail. The Union Leader reports again that Omadi has a criminal record that dates back to August of 2013 when he was arrested and charged with attempted robbery at the ripe old age of 18. So when his public defender, or when his attorney, says, look, he's not a danger to society. He's being held on this one thing. Well, yeah, that's what he's been charged with. It's not the only thing he's ever been held on. Right now he's being held on this one thing. But in the past, he's been held on some other things, like attempted robbery. Allegedly held a knife to a woman's throat during a robbery at the Residence Inn in Rochester. Heroin stolen from his victim's bra by a female co-conspirator. Same day. Later in the day, Dover officers responded to an apartment where a man claimed two men had assaulted him with a stun gun, stole a laptop computer, as well as some prescription drugs. Omadi pleaded guilty to a Class B felony in the robbery there in Dover. The Rochester case, the case of the woman who had heroin stolen from her bra, was null pros, which means that they decided not to prosecute. Kept the case open, but they decided not to prosecute. They had a better case, presumably with the Dover robbery. At the time, the Union Leader says there was talk of deporting Omadi, but that appears not to have actually gone anywhere. Prosecutor says he doesn't know what Omadi's immigration status is. Said certainly the arrest for a felony would trigger some sort of inquiry, but whether an inquiry has been conducted by the federal government, I am not sure. Huh. Public information officials from the U.S. Customs and Immigration Enforcement say that they've been looking into Omadi's status to see what action the federal government has taken, if any. And they report that ICE has lodged an immigration detainer against Mr. Omadi with local authorities. At the conclusion of the pending criminal case, he'll be turned over to ICE custody and placed into removal proceedings. You know, it's interesting. When we talk about these individuals who are responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime in any given community, often these individuals are not just responsible for a disproportionate amount of violent crime, they're the victims of a disproportionate amount of violent crime, too. This appears to be the case with Mr. Omadi. He is the same man who was allegedly shot in the chest, the union leader says, by Kerry Joseph of Rochester in July of 2014. A judge declared a mistrial on Joseph's attempted murder charge in August of 2015. A jury deadlocked for 10 hours. Now, if he is convicted of the current Class A felony that he faces, Mr. Amati could face 15 years in prison and a $4,000 fine. He is expected to go to trial this summer. So we will keep our eyes on the case of Okemudi Omati, the ripe old age of 21 there in New Hampshire, already developing a very lengthy criminal history. And our other deal of the day, our new deal, another name to keep an eye on here in the future, Burlington Free Press. Actually, it's a guy to keep your eye on right now because he's apparently on the loose. Burlington, Vermont. Actually, Colchester, Vermont. Say that they are continuing the search for an attempted murder suspect. 29-year-old Patrick J. Bombard of Williston, Vermont. Sergeant James Roy with the Colchester Police says that Bombard is a person of interest in the case. Police believe that Bombard is responsible for shooting 36-year-old Travis Carl twice. Police haven't released a lot of details about why Bombard allegedly shot this man, although the sergeant said evidence suggests the incident may have been related to the drug trade. But the Burlington Free Press points out that Mr. Bombard is well known to authorities there. Lengthy criminal history in the county, Chittenden County. Bombard has no criminal convictions in Chittenden County, according to court papers. But the victim in this case, Mr. Carl, has a lengthy criminal history dating back to 1997. This is the guy who was shot allegedly in the drug deal or drug debt gone bad. The victim in this case, 5 felony convictions, 10 misdemeanor convictions, and now again doesn't stand formally accused, but apparently there may have been some evidence that Mr. Carl was involved somehow with some illegal narcotics. Once again, he already has been convicted of 2 counts of selling heroin, sale of cocaine, possession of heroin, escape, simple assault, trespass, retail theft, possession of stolen property, and another case where, again, it looks like not just the offender but the victim appears to be well known to law enforcement. Now, our good guy of the day, from the Sacramento Bee, a California Highway Patrol officer in Monterey, California, driving there. I think he was on duty, but the car in front of him, as he's on the road, all of a sudden catches on fire. It was Highway 1. It was about 10 o'clock in the morning. And it just so happened that behind the highway patrol officer and behind the car that caught on fire was a photographer for the Monterey Herald there in Monterey, California, Vern Fisher. He said, "I was behind the CHP when all of a sudden I just saw an explosion of smoke and flames coming from under the hood of the car." He said the lights of the patrol car went on and the car pulled onto the exit, but it didn't immediately stop. The people inside, I think, were panicking a little bit. Now, Vern Fisher said he could see the car dropping smoking, flaming pieces to the ground as it's rolling along the road there. It pulled into the parking lot of a hotel, comes to a stop. Oscar Lowe's, a California Highway Patrol public information officer, said the officer, Kaleo Clissold, ran up to the driver's side door of the car but couldn't get the door open. The officer yelled at the driver and passenger to get out, realized that there were children there in the back seat. The officer was able to pull out one child from the car, yelling at the passenger. Another passenger had exited the car on her own, said, "Here, take your kid. What are you doing? Come on." Then went back to save the second child from the car that was filling up with smoke. Reaching in through the passenger side, unlocking the back door, pulling the child to safety. The driver escaped by climbing over onto the passenger side and then exiting the car. The story there in the Monterey Herald says the driver just kind of walked away from the burning vehicle. The officer yelled out, "Come here, your car's on fire." All four of the occupants, including the two children, treated on scene by fire and ambulance personnel, taken to the local hospital there because of smoke inhalation. Thankfully, the officer is okay, and it looks like all four are going to recover. But Officer Kaleo Clissold there in Monterey, California, in the right place at the right time, and definitely stepping up and doing the right thing. We thank you for being one of the many, many good guys out there. All right, Robbie Suave of Reason is going to join us on the program. His latest piece in the Daily Beast on the college that wants to ban history, the Assembly for Power and Liberation. I'm not sure if they want to set up a some sort of guillotine on campus. That might be in their demands for the fall semester. But so far this spring, they just want to start a new college. They want to have a student committee that will police speech on campus. And then they also want culturally segregated living arrangements there as well. Because, again, it's not apparently about exposing yourself to all kinds of new and different ideas in college. No. That's not apparently what college is all about anymore. Stick around. We've got a lot more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, coming up right after this.
I'm speaking with Sergeant Major Lance Nutt. He's president and founder of Sheepdog Impact Assistance. Tell us what Sheepdog Impact Assistance is all about.
Well, when we refer to the term of sheepdog, it's referring to one of society's protectors. It's the men and women that serve in the military, law enforcement, fire and rescue ranks. It's that type of man or woman that's willing to put their life on the line for you and me, for everyday service and the things that we live and take for granted. It takes a unique individual to go out there and make sure that we're able to appreciate the freedoms that exist for us. And when we talk about society's protectors, it's truly its sheepdogs, those men and women willing to give it all.
So where did this concept come from?
Well, for us and myself as a Marine of 28 years, it was quickly understanding with multiple deployments under my back and so many of my own Marines and soldiers and sailors that I had served with, seeing the difficulties they had in returning home. Part of that was that continued service opportunity. When you step away from something that means so much to you and having given so much of your life in service, we felt that we needed an organization that would give you that opportunity to continue giving back to your country. And we initially formed as a disaster response organization and have morphed into so much more that truly defines who and what we are as individuals, our members and our volunteers. But more importantly, we're making sure that those men and women that have suffered a traumatic injury, and that could be emotional or physical trauma, that we give them the opportunity to get up off their butts and continue to live their lives.
It's awesome. Sergeant Major Lance Nutt with Sheepdog Impact Assistance. How can we get more information about your wonderful organization?
Well, we encourage people to visit our website at www.sheepdogia.org, and that's that'll give them an opportunity to learn a lot more about what we're accomplishing and how we're helping these men and women continue on with their lives.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for what you're doing. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
I'm speaking with Chris Midget with the Firearms Guide. Chris, you've got a really exciting, neat product. Tell folks, what is the Firearms Guide?
Firearms Guide is a huge firearms, airguns, and ammunition searchable guide or a reference guide that it's online. Web address is firearmsguide.com. It's a subscription-only website, but it's not only a website. It's a huge searchable firearms and ammunition reference guide that it has its own search engine built inside of it, so all the users can actually search all these guns by the 14 different search criteria, by caliber, by country of origin, by year of production, by the type of the gun. Do I want to check rifle or a shotgun? Do I want to check semi-automatic shotgun over and under shotgun, side-by-side shotgun, or maybe lever-action shotgun?
Wow, that's impressive. So so how did this come about? It sounds like a really neat resource to have.
Yes, we've been developing this for over 8 years. We published 5 previous editions on DVDs, and this 6th newest edition will not be published on DVD. We actually just publish it online in the form of searchable database.
Wow, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So who's the kind of person, Chris, that would use the firearms guide? Give me a typical customer.
You know what? Typical customer is any gun enthusiast. Let me say that you're looking for a new concealed carry pistol. How are you going to find? You cannot Google these things. You cannot put in a Google, please show me concealed carry pistol. You press search and you get 65,000 websites. With us, you go to Firearms Guy. First click, you click on hangers. Then you choose caliber. For example, let me say 380. Then after that, you choose barrel length, because barrel length is
right.
Also one of the search criteria. So you choose something small, like 3-inch barrel length.
Right.
You want your concealed carry pistol to be light. So you choose frame material instead of steel. Let me say, let it be polymer.
All right, before we run out of time, how do you get more information about it?
Please go to firearmsguide.com. Everything is there.
Firearmsguide.com. Thanks, Chris. Thanks for being on NRA News.
Thank you very much. Keep good work.
Welcome back to NRA News. Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Kurt Schlichter on the way. Right now, I want to welcome to the program from Reason Magazine, writing in the Daily Beast on the college that wants to ban history. Robbie Suave is with us. Robbie, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing great. Glad to be here.
It's good to have you. And on a very appropriate day, because the hashtag the triggering is apparently trending on Twitter right now.
That's right.
So there's all kinds of, I guess, you know, Twitter is just an unsafe space today. Maybe we're going to have an online campus or an online assembly for power and liberation. I guess we do have the Twitter Safety and Security Speech Council, whatever the heck that's called, right?
Yes, that kind of Orwellian-sounding little council that's full of only lefty groups that hate free speech. That's no exaggeration to say that.
Yeah, yeah. And it's interesting. I was on Twitter last night, and I saw that you were engaged in a conversation with somebody who was trying to say, you know, look, this is – You're making a mountain out of a molehill, Robbie. You keep writing about all of these attacks on free speech from student activists, but they're not the ones with power, right? So why aren't you writing about the people in positions of power and authority on campus who are trying to go after the free speech rights of these activists? Only that's not really what's happening here.
Right, and actually, I don't even think that was Jeet here, the New Republic, and Angus Johnson. Student activism, and I actually think neither of them were even willing to admit that. Well, that Angus Johnson in some cases, but Jeet here was kind of denying that anyone is the free speech rights are threatened on campus, which is, as my colleague pointed out, a mark of his privilege that he doesn't represent an ideology that would come under attack on a college campus. In some cases, the administrations are of college campuses; those people are cracking down on students. In some cases, it's those people cracking down on students because other students are telling them to. I certainly think this threat is occasionally exaggerated, but it's not wholly exaggerated. There are case after case after case of dissident student or professor who said something uncomfortable, innocuous, getting railroaded off campus. It happens every day.
Absolutely. And it's interesting because, you know, we're obviously following the campus carry debate around the country. And this is one of the big arguments that you hear against campus carry is that I will be afraid that that my speech will be chilled here if we have a concealed carry holders on campus. And you know, I think it's important to point out that speech is being chilled and it has nothing to do with campus carry. It's happening right now. It has everything to do with groups like the Assembly for Power and Liberation, which is a student-run group at Western Washington University, and they have released a list of demands, right?
Yes. These demands are similar in some ways to student activist demands at a number of other colleges, although more insane. They called for the creation of an entirely new college called the College for Power and Liberation that would basically be a kind of social justice activism indoctrination camp. And they also called for a student-run committee that would investigate and fire professors, even tenured professors, who say offensive things or things anyone perceives to be offensive. They also want culturally segregated, safe living spaces, which is a bizarre kind of new demand that students are making. They don't want, like, you know, diversity and multiculturalism. They want, you know, this is a this is a student for this is a space for students of color, this is a space for gay students, this is a space, and so on and so forth, which is kind of a, well, an inversion of what you think, like, the liberal activists would have wanted or fought for in decades past. So all these things, you know, they're the college president said, you know, if we even started to give you these things, we'd be violating our own policies and the law, the First Amendment. But that's nevertheless what the students want.
Well, maybe they'll leave, Robbie. Maybe they'll just not go on campus, and won't that teach them a lesson?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and just like you said with the campus carry debate, I mean, it's amazing how much, like, the students that have this mindset, they think they're so unsafe. They think they're so threatened. They think people disagreeing with them is akin to violence, and they're in mortal peril if they encounter disagreement. They're perturbed in any way. It's the same as someone attacking them physically. It's the torturing of the word safety into something that's meaningless as a concept.
It is, and yet it's also, you know, fairly common here. I mean, you talk about at Western Washington University, these activists want to create an office for social transformation, right, which would employ, as you say, 15 students, young Robespierres in training. I like that. For the purposes of monitoring racist, anti-black, transphobic, cis-sexist, misogynistic, ableist, homophobic, Islamophobic, and otherwise oppressive behavior on campus. Now, I like how they just throw in otherwise oppressive behavior on campus. But as you point out, anti-Semitism, curiously omitted. As a matter of fact, I mean, just,
right.
You know, simply religious bigotry, something, a phrase
right.
that would be as all-encompassing as that, nah, not so much. We're interested in policing some speech and not others.
Right, right, right. And obviously the administration, the university has a responsibility to protect students from actual, like racial violence, things of that. It has to keep them actually physically safe, of course. But they think the word history is triggering because it's history. It's gendered. It's male, even though even though history and his come from different language traditions. There's not history is not because it's male. That's not the reason why that's the word.
No, it must be,
but
because it's his story, Robbie. Wow.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
So this is, you know, and like that little anecdote, I think, says a lot, because there's a lot of academic gobbledygook that comes along with these demands, typically, right? But it's this sort of pseudo-intellectual position here where you say, oh, we got to change the word history because it's sexist, because it's H-I-S, and so it should be, well, they want to replace the I with an X, right?
Right.
H-X.
Right.
How do you even pronounce right. that?
Yeah, I think you pronounce it the same way, but you don't have to read it in a way that would trigger you as a marginalized non-male, I think is the idea. I've seen they've done it to Latino and Latina students, because there you have to pick a gender. You have to be a man or a woman there. So they put X on the end instead of O or A. And I don't know how you're supposed to pronounce that. And I think that's a little, isn't that kind of cultural appropriation? If you're telling people how in their tradition they should, your gendered pronouns don't fit our modern English liberal understanding. Kind of funny. I've seen that before too.
Well, you know, this is a serious question. I guess, Robbie, can you be, would these activists say that you, Robbie, can be microaggressed against?
Me, probably not. I probably check all the wrong boxes. It's a very unique to them, because at the same time they're saying everyone who complains about anything should be heard and is right. We believe all victims. Anyone who says they're harassed, it's entirely subjective. It's on them. But on the other hand, no, it has to, like, they omit anti-Semitism. They're very much thinking about just people on the left being bothered. And like, this college would add a whole new kind of social justice field that's already represented on the campus. They have tons of left-leaning social justice-y organizations. They have a women's center, a gay center, and I'm fine with all of that. That's fine. But you're not increasing the diversity of the college to create this new group that would do the same thing that's already being done. I mean, where's the college center for limiting government or something? You know, they would never have that. That would be too triggering, probably.
And do I read this correctly in the Daily Beast? You say that these activists wanted an extra $50,000 to throw a kickoff party for the new college. I'm assuming many of these same activists are also complaining about the cost of going to college.
They don't complain about the cost of going to college nearly enough. I guess they probably think you and I and everyone else should just be paying more for it. But, I mean, that's the true scandal is here. How much demands like this would increase the cost of college, and in fact are actually the reason why college is skyrocketing. Colleges have to hire all these administrators to comply with new federal government dictates and demands and things of that nature. This is the bubble. This is the problem. And it's a scandal, and it's terrible, and I think college should be more affordable. I stand in solidarity with activists who think that. It's a shame.
Listen, as a parent of three individuals who are not yet of college age, I stand with those folks, too. But is it... It seems to me like I've seen this statistic before. Certainly on some campuses this is the case, but is it fairly common now for administrators to actually outnumber teaching faculty on a college campus?
They wildly outnumber them, I think. And they've increased. Really, the faculty have not driven up the cost of education whatsoever, if you look at it. Faculty wages are at least for your average regular faculty, there are, you know, a couple celebrity faculty who are making a ton of money. But basically, those employment levels have held constant, and their wages have held constant. Meanwhile, they're just hiring an army of administrators to provide student services, really to kind of like limit free expression. I mean, what are these administrators doing? They're sitting around finding ways to limit free expression on campus.
Talking again with Robbie Zawabi of Reason. And Robbie, have we hit rock bottom yet? Have we come close to rock bottom, you think?
Every time I think we've hit rock bottom, maybe I'm wrong. I mean, this is just the latest thing. Did you see that feminist glacier study this week? Out of some, the University of Oregon was promoting a study that they spent the taxpayer money, taxpayer dollars on, that was a feminist approach to understanding glaciers. Yes, the giant hunks of ice. How our understanding of that has been gendered.
I did see that. $709,000.
Yeah.
Yes, on feminist glaciology. Glaciers, gender, and science.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, that one is a new low, but I expect to be amazed by something else next week. So.
Well, I suppose, you know, look, I mean, all things considered, I was going to say, I suppose you never have something, you never lack for something to write about, but I think all things considered, you'd probably accept that trade-off of finding a column topics a little bit more difficult if it meant that sanity was restored to college campuses?
No, I'm an opportunist. I can't even see that. I don't know what I would do if these things were. How would I keep myself busy? No. The more the better. Bring it on.
Have you been invited to speak on a college campus, Robbie?
I've not spoken. I visited them frequently. I've not spoken on one in a while on a campus. No. I'm sure I would draw some my sort of scrutiny and skepticism of some campus sexual assault statistics would certainly not win me many fans on college campuses.
Well, I think Reason on Tour would be absolutely brilliant on college campuses. I think that they could use a dose of some of the reasonable minds there at Reason.
No, thank you. We might do that.
All right, let me know. Robbie, listen, I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always a pleasure.
Anytime. Thank you.
Robbie Zawabi joins. You can find his latest piece at the Daily Beast, The College That Wants to Ban History. I did talk with Kurt Schlichter about setting up an ATF tour with me being the representation of F. Tony Katz, I thought, would be a fantastic representation of the tobacco. And then I thought Kurt could handle the alcohol part. We could do an ATF tour of college campuses. I'm sure that would be very triggering as well. All right, when we come back here on this edition of NRA News, Cam and Company, we're going to speak with Mr. Kurt Schlichter. We do have on our Twitter feed right now the link to Robbie's piece on the college that wants to ban history. The word history. And I'm sure the actual history as well, right? The entire piece, as I say, is well worth reading from Robbie. He says, at the heart of this effort lies a bizarrely totalitarian ideology. And this is something that we talked about in the last segment here. Robbie says, student activists think that they have all the answers, that everything is settled, and that people who dissent are not merely wrong, but they're actually guilty of something approaching a crime. If they persist in this wrongness, They are perpetuating violence by holding an unacceptable opinion, by not admitting or acknowledging that they are wrong, by bitterly clinging to their own opinions and beliefs. They are, again, according to the minds of these activists, perpetrating violence. I don't know. Apparently we stopped teaching. Cameron, growing up, do you remember sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me? Did you ever learn that?
Absolutely.
When did that stop being a thing?
That's long gone. That doesn't exist.
I mean, because... No, absolutely not. Now, it sticks and stones may break my bones, but words can wound too. So watch your mouth, right?
Racist.
If you care about people at all, you will watch what you say. It's just... And as Robbie says... when it comes to spelling history with an X, he says, if a member of campus were to insist on the proper spelling of the word, would he or she or Z have to answer to the Committee for Social Transformation? I mean, like, think about that for a second, right? Again, if speech is violence, if opinions are violence, and you've got these activists saying, we demand that we not teach history, we teach history. I don't know, again, how you pronounce it, but it can't be pronounced history because that wouldn't, just inserting the letter X wouldn't do a darn thing then if you're still pronouncing it history. But whatever it is that you're teaching, if you insist on spelling it with an I, do you get called before the Committee for Social Transformation because you're not helping the transformation of that campus? You're not going along with the program. And what should happen to those individuals who don't go along with the program? See, now we really get into free speech and free expression and what it means to be able to hold an unpopular point of view. You know, for a long time in this country's history, the left was on the counterculture. And they fought for things like freedom of speech and freedom of expression because they wanted to be able to express their own ideas. On college campuses these days, the left probably isn't the counterculture. The counterculture is probably conservatism or libertarianism. And do those same folks, the same student activists whose ideological forefathers and mothers, don't want to trigger anybody here, four people, who created things like the free speech movement on college campuses 50 years ago, do their ideological descendants today realize and recognize that they're now the complete 180 of what those students were fighting for back in the early 1960s? Because back in the 60s, you know, they were fighting for people to be heard. Even at Berkeley, you had the free speech movement. Then you had the foul speech movement, basically the right to cuss as often and as loudly. Well, that battle's been won, hands down. But back then, the students were fighting to expand what they could say. Now, many of those same students are in a position of authority on campus. They've moved into the front offices. They've moved into the positions of deans and university presidents. And now you've got students who are fighting for the right to shut people up. And again, what's really sad is those folks who were on the front lines arguing for more freedom of speech back in the 60s, many of them are falling silent now. All right, when we come back here on NRA News, Cam and Company, Kurt Schlichter will join us, the author of Conservative Insurgency, many, many columns as well. We'll be right back with more NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler, right after this. Right now, Yeah, we have a good guy segment on the program each and every day. Well, here is a real-life good guy. Major Ed Polito is with us from the Folds of Honor Foundation. Major, it's good to see you again, sir.
Man, what a great day to be an American.
Yes, yeah. Sir. How are you?
I'm doing great, man. I'm just excited. Look, at when you get to come here, this is freedom right here.
Right.
And you get to see all of the great things that are, all the great people, all the great items that are here, and certainly the hardware, man. I tell you what, it doesn't get better than that, and this is about the USA, baby. Yeah, in Vegas.
That's right. So tell me, for folks who haven't been able to catch you on the program before, those few Americans out there who still are unaware of the Folds of Honor Foundation, what does this organization do?
Well, the Folds of Honor Foundation was started by Major Dan Rooney, and as a co-founder of the organization, I've been with Major Dan on this mission for about 8 years. We give scholarships to the families that have fallen and wounded. But we've awarded over 10,000 scholarships. This year, we'll probably do another 2,500 to deserving military families, honoring the sacrifice, educating the legacy, and providing healing and support for these wounded service members that come back and are disabled and that they need that hope and that support. And I think, you know, NRA News has been with us from day one. And, you know, we've got so many great sponsors that are part of it. Here just in the show, you know, Colt Bushnell, got 511 Tactical down there. We're going to do a book signing at 2:30 this afternoon at the 511 Tactical booth, and we're just spreading the message about freedom and sacrifice and the Folds of Honor.
You know, and it's so important, especially for those of us who never wore the uniform and we never served. We have, I think, an obligation to help those who have. And, you know, I never wore the uniform, but my dad was in the Navy in World War II. My brother was in the Army during Desert Storm, was in Korea at the time. And I've lived around military families, and I've gotten to see firsthand not only how the soldier or the yes. sailor or the airman, how they are impacted, but how their entire families are making sacrifices each and every day. And when we're talking about our wounded warriors, you know, those families, they're going through so much. That it's easy for us to forget, right? We don't see the news stories every day anymore about our soldiers in Iraq or Afghanistan. In fact, our special ops guys, you know, they work very quietly. And
Correct.
So we're not supposed to see the headlines, but they're there and they are serving, and we need to serve them. So what can we do to get involved with Folds of Honor?
Well, people can go to foldsofhonor.org and get involved. They can also do a lot of buy the products that we have out here. The other thing I will tell you is that as you serve this great nation, and as I put on the nation's uniform, lost my leg, almost lost my life, I always think about, you know what, I did what I did to preserve freedom in this nation. And for all of us in this nation to have everything that we've got, to live and have a great quality of life. And you just explained that to us, to your listenership, you know. It's about honoring that sacrifice, but more importantly, about making sure that around the world that they know the United States of America is nobody to be messing around with. Because at the end of the day, our people stand up for freedom.
Now, okay, so to that end, I want to ask you something as Major Ed Polito, not with the Folds of Honor Foundation, but just Major Ed Polito for a second. How concerned are you that that America's enemies are starting to get a different message, that maybe we can be pushed around a little bit?
Well, I got to tell you that we cannot sit around and let people push us around. And I am a big advocate. In my book, Warrior for Freedom, I wrote about Ronald Reagan and his message to the world that, you know what, not only are you going to tear that wall down, but if you do something and you get out of line, we're going to bust you up. And I got to tell you, that's the way I look at things. You know, we cannot sit around in this world that's so negative with ISIS doing what they're doing. And then, of course, them kind of infiltrating our country and then this refugee problem and all of this. And our leadership, our poor leadership, not understanding that at the end of the day, it's not about saying that individuals can't come here and follow the American dream. It's about making sure that when you come here, you learn not only our language, our customs, but you live as an American. And I got to tell you, the culture, I'm Colombian and Puerto Rican. My father was an immigrant. I truly understand that the red, white, and blue shines bright because people like him, a Vietnam-era vet, took that oath of office to love his country, to love his family, and to have faith in God. And I think that's the elements of who we are in this nation.
Welcome back to NRA News, Cam and Company, sponsored by Nosler. Coming to you once again from Farmville, Virginia, where I have to say I don't even think we are immune to what we're seeing here on college campuses. We do have Longwood University. We have Hampden-Sydney College in Farmville, Virginia. Both beautiful places. Longwood going to be host of the vice presidential debate, but I don't think you can avoid the craziness that we're seeing on college campuses. Kurt Schlichter joins us on the program, the author of Conservative Insurgency. How you doing, my friend?
I'm doing great. Good to see you last week, and I certainly appreciate the probably the best replacement song is my bumper music. And that's saying something.
You know, okay, so I have to confess, my earpiece came out right as I was running back into the studio. I didn't hear the music. What was the bumper music for you this week?
Oh, my gosh. It was
well, you said best replacement song ever. Oh, okay. All right. That would have been one of my top five.
Yeah, it's in the top five.
Speaking, since we've got the triggering as a hashtag on Twitter, you know, the replacements had some pretty triggering songs, right? Like Waitress in the Sky.
Yes.
That might be the most triggering song in the replacements oeuvre.
Kiss You on the Bus. There's nothing about affirmative consent there. Nothing.
That's true. That's true. And Can't Hardly Wait.
Can't hardly wait. Well, maybe you should, Mr. Patriarch.
Yeah. It was good to see you at CPAC last week as well. And thank you for being a part of the most chaotic and talked about segment on the program in quite some time.
That was insane. It was like the all-stars of Destroying Cam show.
All in one place. It was fantastic. And I felt so bad. Like Larry O'Connor afterwards was like so sympathetic. He was like, was that okay? Were you okay with that? I was like, I was fine. He's like, because you kept trying to like bring it back to being serious. I'm like, well, that's what I do. But, you know, clearly there was no way that was going to happen, but that's what I do. I have to try
to
remain.
There's no less rewarding role than being the voice of reason around that crew.
I have to try to maintain some sort of decorum, because if I don't, if all of a sudden everybody else there realized, oh, well, Cam's just decided to let it go, then, you know, I don't know. There's not a long enough delay in the world for what could have happened there.
No, that's absolutely true. You are completely correct, but I think a good time was had by many.
I think that you're right. And, you know, as I said, we've been talking a lot about speech on college campuses today. I brought up with you the ATF tour, right? You, me, Tony
yep.
Katz.
I love that.
You would represent alcohol. You would not have a problem
yep.
with that, right?
No.
Okay, I didn't think so.
No.
Tony would represent the world of tobacco. I would represent the world of farms. We could go talk to college students, listen to what college students have to say. A dialogue, if you will, Kurt Schlichter.
And have them protest us.
That's what passes for a dialogue on college campuses.
That would be fun. I feel unsafe. No, you feel unsmart.
You know, and I every time I hear that phrase, you know, the safe space on a college campus, you are one of the people that I think about, because you and I have had so many conversations over the years about your service overseas, the young men who served under you.
Yep.
And, you know, the fact of the matter is, Kurt, I mean, you know this as well as I do, we've got hundreds of thousands of young men and women in our military right now, same age as these shrieking snowflakes on college campuses. And they are putting themselves, frankly, in some very unsafe spaces so that these college students can live their privileged life.
I know. You know, I can't get angry. I'm just embarrassed for them, because I got a chance to lead these 18-year-olds, 19-year-olds, 20-year-olds, war, peace, civil operations. And, you know, I'm just so endlessly impressed by our troops and their character and their courage and their wisdom and their smarts. I mean, these are, you know, it's funny. I listen to these college students, Cam, and they're not only unwise. I don't expect a 19-year-old to be wise, but they're dumb. They're not smart. You know, they're not quick. They're not interested. They're not curious. They're closed-minded and dull and boring. And then I remember the troopers I worked with, many who didn't have the advantages these, you know, snowflakes have.
Mm.
They didn't get to go to Princeton. They, you know, they work for everything they've got.
You know,
and they're smart and they're clever and they see a challenge and they don't run away and hide. They move out towards it. And they love the excitement. They love being challenged. They love the toughness of the life, and they love that they're doing something important that's more important than their own short-term interests and their own, and living out their own personal psychodramas like these college freaks do. And the comparison between them is so stark. The contrast is so total. I can't take these college people seriously. I feel bad for them, Cam. I'm embarrassed for them.
Look, I feel bad for them, too, because what you said something that Robbie Suave wrote about in the Daily Beast. He said something very similar. I said something very similar as well here. He wrote, student activists think that they have all the answers. Everything is settled, and people who dissent are not merely wrong, but actually guilty of something approaching a crime. You talk about that closed-mindedness, the dull conformity, right, where you've got students who ostensibly are going to college to get an education, but there's a certain subset of these students who think they know everything that there is to know right now, and they are actually in a position to educate their professors and the administrators, and of course the general public. That's why these students are there speaking out, so that they can educate all of us.
Well, exactly, and this is nothing new. Young people have always, and always do, consider themselves being possessed of some wisdom that all of civilization has overlooked in its thousands of years, but in the last, 18, they figured it all out. And usually our institutions are designed to address that if they're used. You have professors who can look at you and look at these kids and smile and go, no, you're completely wrong. Sit down, shut up, and open your mind. If the professors have never grown up themselves, if the professors are weak and afraid, and we saw that in the 60s, we're seeing it again today, they'll get run over. And these kids are little predators. They know that. They smell weakness. Do you see these guys at Hillsdale College? Imagine you walking into the president of Hillsdale College, Larry Arnn, and going, we've decided we want a diversity forum, and we're going to stop having all these dead white males in our Western Civ. Here's our 55 pages of demands. He'd laugh at them and then boot them out, which is why they never happened. Imagine that. If one of your kids came up to you and said, Dad, I have a list of demands. Yeah, exactly. There
right.
You go. I'd go, that kid, that is the funniest thing I've ever heard. You're hilarious.
Right? Let me see that
list.
You're
joking, right?
Yeah.
Because if you're not, I'm taking you to a shrink. Because obviously you have never met your dad or your mom, for God's sake. You know her, too.
Yeah.
How do you think that'd go with Arena?
Oh, I can just imagine,
poorly.
Right? Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. I mean, unfortunately, I think in many cases, these administrators and these faculty members are certainly, they're not doing these students any favors by encouraging this, by not saying, okay, look, there are some things that you don't know. That to me is, and you talk about the administrators, I said this in the last segment here, a lot of these administrators grew up in the 60s. As you say, they were on college campuses in the 60s when things like the free speech movement, which was all about expanding what you could talk about on a college campus. That was the fight of the day.
More accurately be the free speech for us movement.
Well, now we're seeing
not free
that
speech
that's
for the, you and me, free speech for them.
Right. But when they were the counterculture, that's what they were fighting
yeah.
for. When they're the dominant culture on campus, they're not fighting for that anymore. Now they're fighting for the suppression of speech.
They're little fascists. And look, I deal with it, where I hire millennials to work in my law firm. And I hire good ones, and they have good care, and they seem to be smarter than the average bear. One of them's going to become a Reserve Army officer. These are good kids with care. But they sometimes show some millennial issues. And it's a splash of cold water in the business world. When I sit down and I say, let me tell you a couple things. First of all, attorneys are fungible. One attorney, I can replace you any time, and there are a bunch of people willing to do it. Second of all, you are not special. In fact, you are a liability right now because you don't know how to do things. You spent your whole life being told that you're good at something. You are now going into a field where you are not good at something. You are actively bad, so you should listen and learn so you can become good and earn respect. And this is a business. The most important thing is not your feelings. The most important thing is not even your interests. It's my interest because this is my company. You are here to make money for me. In that process, you will make money for you and discover and develop and perhaps develop opportunities of your own, which you can expand so that eventually other people will be working for you. This is how this works. It's not about validating you. It's about enriching me. That's how the world works. And they're just like, But, you know, when they start improving and they get better and they bring in their own clients and then they get a cut of that. You know, when you get a check saying, hey, this is extra money you earned because you brought this client in, you get a piece of the action. That's a real achievement. That's not patting on the head and saying, you special snowflake. That's a ka-ching, man, and there's nothing better than a ka-ching.
You would know. Out there in California.
I did work a lot of years getting here.
Well, there you go. But, you know, and to your point, we've only got another couple of minutes left here, but I remember we were up at the Great American Outdoor Show in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, not long ago, and we were talking with a former member of the military. And you know, we were talking about this mindset of the guys who are in the special forces, because that's what this gentleman did. They never assume I know everything. Right. They never assume, all right, I've got it down now. I'm good to go.
Oh, that's not just the special forces. That's anybody who's got half a brain.
Right. But you never stop learning. You never stop challenging yourself. You never stop, again, making yourself uncomfortable. That's what I don't understand about the whole concept of safe spaces.
Exactly. And that's the whole thing of the military. You're always moving. As soon as you get good at a job, they move you to the next one. You're always in a learning curve. When you become a commander of a unit, for instance, you know, I remember I watched, I'm like, what the hell do I do? And by the time I figured it out, we were running like a well-oiled machine, I got pulled out and sent somewhere else. And you don't know everything. You can't. You've got to surround yourself with good people. You rely on your sergeants. You rely on your troops. You rely on your intel officer and your finance officer and your admin officer and your operations officer. You're relying on these guys. You know, as a commander, there were a whole bunch of guys who were, you know, now I had done a lot of these jobs, so I was really good at those. And I was probably the best as the battalion commander. I was the best company commander because I'd been a company commander. But these guys all knew some stuff I didn't. And like the guys who were company commanders when I was a battalion commander, they had new equipment I hadn't had.
Kurt, unfortunately, you know that.
I had to learn from them.
You know that music means we got to run. You've learned that from me. But I appreciate you coming on the program, sir. It's always good talking with you. We'll talk to you soon. Kurt Schlichter joining us out from California. We'll see you tomorrow on another edition of NRA News Cam & Company, sponsored by Nosler.